career as an alleged broadcaster and chronicler of current affairs, I am genuinely engaged by the looming budget. We covered the income tax angle yesterday, and today it's the child benefit cap, the two-child benefit cap. The idea that if you have more than two children and fall upon hard times, you get no help from the state, because we all hate so much the people who have more than two children and haven't fallen on hard times. They have elected as a lifestyle choice to live in them. Apparently, it is unpopular with Labour MPs, the cap, but popular with voters. Really?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, the BBC's outgoing Director General insists he's very proud of journalists at the organisation. Tim Davies spoke as he arrived at the corporation's central London headquarters, where he's due to address staff in an online meeting. He didn't mention the threat of a billion-dollar lawsuit by Donald Trump, though, over the editing of a Panorama documentary.
I'm very, very proud of our journalists in this building. They're doing work, I think, that's incredibly important. I want to thank every one of them. They're doing a wonderful job. Also, everyone across the BBC doing their thing for the UK. The BBC's going to be thriving, and I support everyone on the team. I'm very proud of them.
Prince William is appearing in a video in school assemblies across the country this morning to tell young people about the importance of the poppy. He's speaking to mark Armistice Day, marking the end of the First World War. Army veteran Tim Penny told LBC it's always an emotional time for him.
Obviously, remember those who paid the ultimate sacrifice, those who've been injured in service, but also those whose lives have changed considerably as a result of their service.
We'll be observing the silence at 11 o'clock here on LBC. Police investigating comments made on stage during Bob Villain's set at Glastonbury Festival say they've interviewed a man under caution. Officers say he intended voluntarily yesterday afternoon. There are calls for the UK's Prevent programme to get a radical overhaul. An independent commission has found the definition of terror is too wide and the programme is not fit for purpose. Thousands of barbershops and vape stores have been raided in a crackdown on money laundering. The National Crime Agency says more than 900 people have been arrested in a month in the biggest operation of its kind. And it's emerged a learner driver has failed their theory test 128 times. DVSA figures also reveal two people have taken their practical test 37 times without passing. That would have likely costed more than £2,000 each. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 91 points at 98.78. The pound buys $1.32 and €1.14. LBC weather, rain spreading to the north and west of the UK, but staying dry and bright in the south and east. Highs of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lottie Morley.
Hey Sainsbury's, any recommendations for a cosy Sunday lunch that's easy on the wallet?
How about a whole leg of lamb? Half price with Nectar. Now that's a treat that'll really make your Sunday.
Roast lamb. Comforting, delicious and perfect for leftovers.
Want to save big on your winter roast? Ask Sainsbury's. Sainsbury's, good food for all of us.
Buy Sainsbury's whole leg of lamb offer ends 18th of November. 18 plus, Nectar required. Available in store and online excluding locals. Subject to availability, T&Cs apply.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Three minutes after 10 is the time, and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Listen, I don't really like hyperbole, except when I do. It's also one of those words. I always wonder, does it mean something ever so slightly different to what we generally use it to mean? But no, I don't think it does. It means sort of like overblown and exaggerated, doesn't it? Hyperbole. It's the best. This is the best radio program in history. Well, actually, that's probably not hyperbole. But, okay, how about if you were to talk about this radio program potentially reaches a billion. How many people are there in the world, Keith? Do we know what the population of the world is off the top of our heads? A rough idea? Lots. This radio program potentially reaches billions of people. Is that hyperbole? I think it probably is. It's true. potentially, because you can listen on the internet pretty much wherever you are in the world. But it's obviously hyperbole. It's an exaggeration. And I don't normally like hyperbole. I think it's the kind of the 8.1 billion. It won't be quite that many because some people haven't got the internet. Some people are in North Korea. But anyway, 6 or 7 billion minimum, 6 or 7 billion potentially people. Alert the advertising department. Listening could be listening to this programme right now. And we only count the ones who are listening on the radio. But I don't like hyperbole. I generally don't like hyperbole. But I do feel, and I don't know whether it's a sign of me getting old. First time in my life recently, I've caught myself thinking about what I'm going to leave to my children. And it focuses the mind on financial matters in ways that my mind has never been focused before. I am an idiot, as you know, in so many ways. But on matters like this, when I was a newspaper journalist, I was so grateful to have the job that I often didn't bother doing my expenses. I sort of paid for entertainment. I mean, some journalists live by their expenses. Famously, when I did my first ever shifts on the London Evening Standard, there was a bloke reputed to have put his son through Eton on expenses because they were so generous back in the day. You could just turn up at the cashier's office in the morning without even producing receipts and tell them how much you'd spent the night before on entertaining the great and the good. And there was so much money sloshing around the corridors. But no, that might be apocryphal, but certainly we were very excited by it when we started out in the business. But I've never really got my hand. I've got mates who are right. They could tell you now how much their shares have performed today, up to almost the hour. And obviously, some people had pensions when they were seven. But it's only really when I started looking at the world and what it will look like when I'm not in it anymore for my children, for my girls, that I've started thinking a little bit more about fiscal matters. And I don't think I've become more selfish. But I will not be surprised if I do in the coming years. As the Grim Reaper edges ever closer, the possibility of me becoming a little bit more self-interested when it comes to the economy, when it comes to personal finances, perhaps increases. And I mention all of that because I'm genuinely surprised to discover how interested I am in the coming budget. And the reason why I keep wanging on about hyperbole, is because I think there is an awful lot resting on it, but not quite as much as hyperbole would allow. So hyperbole would tell us that this is make or break for Rachel Reeves. This will decide whether or not Labour goes into the next election with its head held high. This may even be the difference between Keir Starmer making it to the next election and not, or Rachel Reeves being Chancellor this time next year and not. Some of which may be true, some of which may not be true, none of which is either provable or a copper bottomed. But the two-child benefit cap is quite bizarrely, for something that is so provocative, for something that inspires such strong feelings, it is not something that we've talked about a lot on the programme. Partly because there's quite a bit of confusion surrounding what it is, and that is confusion that I hope I don't add to this morning. But I acknowledge that if history is anything to go by, then it's perfectly possible that I will add to it. The report this morning is that come the budget on the 26th of November, Rachel Reeves will get rid of it. That she will, or at least, at the very least, could, is the reporting today, abolish the controversial policy. We know this because she has said that she doesn't think it's right that children are, quote, penalised, end quote, for being part of large families. She also does that thing that is very difficult to properly measure. When you talk about intangible long-term benefits, including financial ones that will offset very tangible short-term losses. So it costs a lot of money, potentially billions of pounds to do this. But she talks about the costs to our economy in allowing child poverty to go unchecked. This story, and you may not think it at first glance, it cuts in many ways to the very heart of politics, actually, and politics is an intrinsically personal thing. One of the great sadnesses of the current era and the madness and the promotion of lies and liars is that people are turning away from the news and people are turning away from proper politics that is complicated and difficult and falling instead into the laps of people who pretend that it's simple and people who lie. And people who mislead and exaggerate and embellish and engage daily in hyperbole. Because you can't do this stuff in cartoon form. You can't do this stuff simplistically.
if you were to measure the impact of child poverty, you'd be looking at 40-year-olds. You'd be looking at 50-year-olds. You'd be wondering how much of where they have ended up is attributable to where they started. And you'd also be wondering how much difference would have been made by having a little bit more money in the family kitty when you were a kid. So everything from you know, being clean and being clothed, being having a full belly and a warm body, all of these things are marks of poverty. Or not having these things are marks of poverty. And it is a fairly reliable indicator of how civilized a society is to look at how it cares for or looks after the people who most need help. Okay, needle scratch, rewind. Because it is also possible to argue that because some people avail themselves of state support without necessarily putting their shoulder to the wheel, then it shouldn't be available to anybody. I've always found that a heartbreakingly bleak analysis of the human condition and of our neighbours, our friends, our family members, to think that because they're almost certainly swinging the lead, the price we'll pay to penalise the lead swingers is to further impoverish the people who do really need help. And then I read in The Guardian this morning, because it's covered fairly equably across all of the newspapers, but this line here I only found in The Guardian, and it describes the cap as being popular with voters, but deeply unpopular among Labour MPs. And that is why it is politically so fascinating. Directly, it is popular with voters. So you apparently, we quite like the two-child benefit cap, which means you don't receive any extra money for children that you have above two children. So you get nothing for your third, fourth or fifth child. And we like that, apparently. But Labour MPs don't. One of the big problems Labour has had in recent years is, whether it's fair or not, I'm not sure. I don't think it happened under Blair, but it's happened subsequently, is that they, and it's a false perception, but it's a powerful one, is that they only care about people who are needier than thou. Yet they only care about minorities, it would be one argument, or the disabled, or the poor, or the unemployed. They only care about people who are needier than thou. And it's a really unhelpful perception from a political point of view, isn't it? Because it appeals to something visceral inside all of us. Well, I'm all for helping people, but I should get a break too. You hear it a lot. We heard it yesterday talking about income tax. People running businesses genuinely believing, whether it's a fair belief or not, that they're being victimised, that they're really struggling, that they're the people the government should be doing more to help. And I don't know why that is. I don't know why this apparently is so unpopular with voters, unless it is a combination of two things. I've only got two children. Why are, quotes, other people, end quotes, getting help? Why are other people getting help? And that perhaps explains why Labour MPs don't like the cap, but voters reportedly do. And then the second bit of it is very, very similar, very, very linked to that feeling of I've only got two children, but it doesn't matter whether you've got any children or not. There's this idea that somebody somewhere is living a wonderful existence on my dollar. Somebody somewhere is living. I get messages about people. I exaggerate slightly when I say your window cleaner's dog's original owner's wife is swinging the lead, and that's proof that everybody is. But it's only a mild exaggeration. There are plenty of people who genuinely get in touch with me to tell me about the person. I got one yesterday claiming that the bloke over the road, the son of the bloke over the road, is faking an illness and gets £45,000 a year in Universal Credit and PIP. And I just thought, two things. Number one, how do you arrive at that figure? And number two, how do you know he's faking his illness? And number three, even if he is, which, spoiler alert, he isn't, what on earth does it say about all the people who aren't? It tells me nothing about all the people who are ill. But there's always that anecdotal heft on stories like this. So, the country, as we discussed yesterday, is skint. It is in dire need of more public spending on infrastructure and services that potentially benefit us all, or protect us all, the police, the NHS, most obviously, I suppose, other areas of infrastructure. And this plan, this policy, according to the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which is a very reliable arbiter in such matters, if you lifted it from 2 to 3 children, you're looking at about £2.6 billion. And if you tapered it where you got the full amount for the first 2 kids and then half of the amount for all subsequent children, it would actually be lower, because most families with more than 2 children will have 3 children. You'd be looking at a cost of about 1.8. So however you dice it, it's in the region of 2 and a bit billion quid. David Blunkett wants to leave the cap in place, but bring in exemptions for disabled children or parents who have been widowed, single parents trying to muddle through, and look at other measures. And David Blunkett can be quite a wise owl in some cases, not all. But it's the YouGov polling that's really interesting. It's 59% of us who are in favour of keeping the cap in place. And I'm about to ask you why. I've offered up some of my answers to that question. And I don't think today is a day to confine the conversation only to people in the 59%. I think the rest of us can analyse what's going on there as well. How fair is it to be opposed to this cap? You know, to ask people who are themselves struggling to essentially find a few more quid, I know that's very simplistic, for people who've chosen to have more children when they haven't. Rachel Rees makes what I think is a very powerful point, but it doesn't seem to touch the sides of, and I guess this is where I want to bring personal experience into the conversation, where you were both in work and you had more than 2 children and your circumstances changed. I always think of the welfare state as a safety net. I don't know when I first came up with that perception, because it's not something I've ever had to rely on myself. But I always think of the welfare state as a safety net. And I think it was when I started using this job, doing this job, and listening to people, not just callers, sometimes even presenters, engaging in the very, very lazy rhetoric of cruelty and division, so that everybody in receipt of benefit X is taking the mickey. It was flat screen televisions when I started. Everybody had a flat screen television. Everybody unemployed had a flat screen television, apparently, as if that was some great emblem of unearned wealth and skiving. All the single mothers. That sounds a bit like a Beyonce track, doesn't it? All the single mothers had a flat screen television, and all the unemployed people had a flat screen television or a Sky satellite dish. You'd hear it. It feels a bit dated now, but you'd hear people saying, I drive around and I see all the Sky satellite dishes on the council houses. And you sort of think, well, if people are living in council housing, it doesn't mean they're unemployed. It doesn't necessarily mean they're poor. They could be working just as hard as you are. Just as entitled to put a satellite dish on the side of their house. So just as entitled to get a flat screen television. But it led me to recognise that there are 2 ways of looking at the welfare state. You look at it either as a safety net that catches us when we fall, helps us get back up again, or you look upon it as a trampoline into which people willingly and gleefully leap in order to bounce about on our tax dollar for the rest of their lives. And I think it would be stupid to pretend that there's nobody in the second category, but it's a fairly bleak and desiccated existence, isn't it? I certainly think it would be equally, if not more, stupid to pretend that the largely anecdotal examples we have of people treating the welfare state like a trampoline rather than a safety net are emblematic or descriptive of the entire cohort of people who have more than 2 children and could really benefit from a little bit of a boost financially. As Rachel Rees points out, there are plenty of reasons why people make decisions to have 3 or 4 children, but then find themselves in difficulties. You've then got adoption, foster caring, lots and lots of different reasons why families change shape and size over time. So, why is it so unpopular? And it doesn't matter whether you... I don't care, in the first instance, whether you like it or don't like it. It just I mean, I may ask you, but I want to pin down, regardless of your personal preferences, why so many of us are opposed to this. 0345 60 60973. And then a little harder, perhaps, or certainly a much smaller number of people will be able to answer this question. How has it affected you? How does it affect you? So, the family cited by Rachel Rees, and look, this is as anecdotal as the window cleaner's wife's dog owner's brother or whatever it was. the two people in work, three children, absolutely going swimmingly, but then something happens. Someone gets ill, someone gets fired, someone struggles to get back into the workplace, and suddenly the financial difficulties that you're facing are massively exacerbated by the fact that the benefit cap was introduced. So why do you think it's so unpopular, the plan to remove it? Let me phrase that better. Why do you think the cap is so popular? It's much more popular than Brexit. 0345 60 60 973. Why do you think the two-child benefit cap is so popular with voters? Okay? And then, what role has it played in your life? Hit the numbers now, you will get through.
LBC.
We had our smart meter installed a year ago, and it's made things so much easier. Not having to submit meter readings or having to deal with estimated bills is great.
A smart meter sends meter readings direct to your energy supplier. It means you get accurate bills, not estimated bills, and you don't even need an internet connection. Call your energy supplier to request a smart meter today.
Real testimonials voiced by actors. Eligibility may vary.
Every investor has a future in mind, whether it's seeing your kids through uni or picturing yourself retiring in Tuscany. The hard part can be knowing how to get there. JP Morgan Personal Investing can help you see the path ahead. With our intuitive app, expert support, and 150 years of JP Morgan's investing experience, you can start making more informed investment decisions today. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 60 60 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
22 minutes after 10 is the time. To be clear, the policy, and this is where things get a little bit hairy, and I could get my stuff wrong, but if I do, you'll soon correct me. What we're looking at is a cap on child benefits for people receiving universal credit or tax credits for their third child. It came in April 2017, and it applies only to children who were born after that date. So it doesn't affect your general child benefit. If you qualify for that, then you get the same for your third or more child than you get for your second child. But if you're on your universal credit child benefit, and this may change your perspective, or it may inform your answer as to why it's unpopular, because if you're on universal credit, you shouldn't have had three or four children. And I'm not going to shoot you down in flames if that's your argument. I'm just going to ask you to explore it. And the sums are a little bit higher, perhaps, than some people may realise. You are looking at £4,068 for the first child, £3,513 for the second. £3,513 if you were born after 2017, and then the same figure for the second child. So £3,500 per child per year, which then becomes zero if you've got a third. And it seems like a lot of money, unless you've tried to clothe, feed, or look after a child in recent years. And the argument that, well, if you can't afford to do it, you shouldn't have the child, works up to a point, except that we're now shutting primary schools at a rate of knots because of demographic reversals. We are a country, for good or for ill, that has demonised immigration to such a point where both policy and personal decisions are going to see it plummet faster than you could possibly imagine, faster than perhaps at any other point in history. The figures that I keep telling you about are just around the corner. And telling our own people not to have more children will only exacerbate those problems. So anyway, look, there's a lot to get into. Let's go to Alan, who's in Manchester. Alan, what would you like to say?
Well, morning, James. I just think, you know, to get to the point, I think people are more selfish these days. I'm a pensioner next year, but, you know, in the past, we had four kids.
Yeah.
And we were poor. You know, we weren't destitute, don't get me wrong. We think like we did have a holiday.
It's about to go a bit Monty Python, is it? Are
we? Yeah. cardboard box, you were lucky. But you know, we didn't have a holiday, James, for 4 years. But then, God bless him, Gordon Brown came in. Working Families Tax Credit, and that was £90 a week. That was like winning the lottery.
Really?
And And then he, the youngest... We got half his nursery fees. And the difference Gordon Brown made, you know, was brilliant. But people say to me, you chose to have four children. I say, yeah. It's a statistic courtesy of Alistair Campbell for you, James.
Go on.
In the 1950s, for every pensioner, there were 20 people in work.
Yeah.
These days, there's three. So we do need more children. It's an invest to save. Pay a bit of child benefit now. We've got the workers for the future.
So, I mean, you see it almost, because, I mean, there's two arguments here. The one is that it becomes an incentive to have more children. And I don't mean that you're doing it for financial reasons. You're just doing it because you can afford to. I'd love to have another child, but I can't afford it. I think perhaps if I was in this category, I could. And now you've got people who aren't on universal credit who would also like to have another child, but can't afford it. And no one's coming along to help them. So no, I don't know that it makes them selfish. If you chop this up in such a way that the financial obstacle to having a third child is taken away for people on universal credit, but not taken away for people in work, it's a bit more nuanced than you and I allow.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. But I just think as a society, sometimes I don't know. We seem to be more selfish, more not caring.
And that demographic argument is really powerful, isn't it? We actually need more children. In this country.
Well, yeah, I will say this. You know, one of my kids is a doctor. You know, courtesy of Alan Johnson doubling the number of junior doctor places.
How interesting. We can't do counterfactuals completely, but when you talked about how life-changing it was for Gordon Brown to introduce those policies, and...
Oh, honestly, James, my wife worked term time. And what she got in wages went on childcare and the rest. History will be very, very kind to Gordon Brown.
I think it's already started. And of course, the thing we can't measure, although I've seen some absolutely eye-watering estimates of how much child poverty costs society in the long term, we can't measure that, really. In really neat and digestible form, can we? We can't say, well, it might sound like a lot of money to give that family that money now, but trust me, in the long run, they're going to pay more tax. They're less likely to fall into poverty and debt themselves. They're less likely to get into criminality. They're going to be more functioning and contributing members of society. They might even end up being doctors.
Yeah, and the thing is, you can't blame children for what the parents have done. James, I was a magistrate for 12 years.
Okay.
And, you know, the thing is, yeah, you can find people, you can do it, but who suffers? Who's going to suffer, the kids? I'm not saying I wasn't a woke liberal. I mean, if I sent you down, you deserved it.
No, I hear you. And that idea, yeah. I mean, at what point do we become responsible for our own actions? I mean, increasingly, I wonder if we're ever fully responsible for our own actions. Even people that I find repellent, I see the unloved child inside them and think you'd be a lot less... repellent if someone had shown you a little bit of love as a child, to take it to extremes. But you have to take responsibility at some point for your actions. Why would you punish a child for the misfortune or the bad decisions of a parent? The child exists, and you are consigning it to a life of poverty by supporting this policy. The child exists and is living in poverty. Rachel Reeves waves her magic wand. That child is not growing up in poverty anymore. I think the figures are, I think it's gone up in the last decade, the number of children living in poverty. What an appalling indictment of our society that is. And you look at how much wealthier people have become. I think the bloke who owns JCB has just given 200 grand to Nigel Farage's outfit. 200 grand, boom, there you go, no problem. There's so much money swilling around at the top of society, and at the bottom, child poverty's gone up. But down with Rachel Reeves? Why? It's 10:30. Lottie Morley has your headlines.
Services will be held across the UK today to mark Armistice Day. The nation will fall silent shortly to mark the end of the First World War. We'll be marking it here on LBC at 11 o'clock. The BBC's outgoing Director General will speak to staff this morning after Donald Trump threatened to sue the organisation. The US President says he wants the corporation to retract false statements made about him in a Panorama documentary. And police investigating comments made on stage during Bob Villain's set at Glastonbury Festival say they've interviewed a man under caution. Officers say he spoke to them voluntarily yesterday afternoon. LBC weather, rain spreading to the north and west of the UK throughout today, highs of 16 degrees.
LBC.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service, recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
To be honest, work had been a slog. I'm a designer, but some nights I was chasing invoices like my full-time job. Now Sage Copilot chases my invoices for me. I just need to click a button and it's done. And I get paid 1 week faster.
Sage Copilot is built with over 40 years of experience helping real businesses like Sophia at Solver Design. That's more than artificial intelligence. That's authentic intelligence. Search Sage Copilot to learn more. Working with 21 customers, each round payments came in 7 days faster with Sage Copilot. T's and C's apply.
A Thames Link train is a place where you can have more me time. A chance to skip traffic and glide to wherever you need to be. With headspace to focus on more important matters. Like if that cloud is a starfish or sunflower. Fast journeys without the rush with great deals at thameslinkrailway.com. Terms apply.
Step aboard the legend of the Titanic, London's award-winning exhibition devoted to the world's most famous ocean liner at Dock X Canada Water. Walk her decks, explore her cabins, discover her secrets. With 360-degree projections, VR, an interactive metaverse, artifacts and more. Book your tickets today at legendoftitanic.com.
When BP asked me to read the voiceover for their new Wild Bean Cafe ad, I thought I knew what to expect. But when they told me I'd be reading the script next to a mountain waterfall, on horseback, strumming a harp, in a hailstorm, naked, ow, 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 ow. Well, that was wildly unexpected. Just like Wild Bean Cafe having a freshly ground signature espresso blend for everything from Americanos to flat whites in a fuel station. Wowzers. Wild Bean Cafe, only at BP. Subject to availability at selected BP stores only.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60 973.
10:32 is the time. James writes, Jeff, following a straw poll in our household, I think you need to explain the difference between child benefit, which is not capped, but some of which is clawed back for high earners, and the universal tax credit, which is capped. It may account for the high support for keeping the cap. I think you're right, Jeff. I've already done that once, but I do acknowledge that not everybody pays as much attention to this programme as I probably should do. But the difference is really, really important. So, I forget what the threshold is for getting it these days. Is it 100,000? What, 50-something thousand, where you don't, if you earn a certain amount of money, 60,000 it is now, and it stops entirely when one of you earns 80,000. So the taper starts at 60, and it's all based on one income. So you could have two people earning £29,999 a year each, and they'd still get it. And then you could have a bloke over the road who is the only, or a woman over the road, the only earner in that household, and they're earning 60,001 pence, and they don't get it. That's not quite true, because there is actually now a taper, that thing they told us they couldn't do with winter fuel allowance. But Jeff makes a valid point. Here's the deal. And this is where, for me, it is actually not quite as old-fashioned an argument as perhaps Alan in Manchester allowed. Because you're not going to get it if you're working and not qualifying for universal credit. Remember, loads of people on universal credit do work, but loads of people working are not on universal credit. So the general child benefit, you get 1,354 for your first child and 897 for all other children after that. That doesn't go away. £897 per child until they reach their majority. But if you are on universal credit, then you get £3,513 a year for the first child, £3,513 a year for the second child. This is all born after 2017. It's a bit more for the first child if you were born before that date. And diddly squat, nada, zip, zero, nil for the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, and if you're Jacob Rees-Mogg, 17th child, in the unlikely event of Jacob Rees-Mogg ever ending up on universal credit. And that's why I think it's a bit more nuanced or a bit more complicated than old-fashioned arguments allow. Because it's not going to be available to everybody. It's only going to be available to people who are on universal credit. So I don't think it makes me a sort of Daily Mail columnist in waiting to point out that that family over there who want a third child can't afford to have one because they don't qualify for universal credit. Depends, I suppose, on how wise you think the thresholds are for universal credit. Because even getting that isn't going to push you above, unless you have a huge number of children, it's not going to push you above the threshold for receiving universal credit. But that perhaps explains the sense of unfairness attached to this cap. I don't know. Because the only argument you ever hear in return is that these children didn't ask to be born. You're penalising them for existing. You're making their life worse than it needs to be. So society steps in and helps by giving the parents money, ostensibly for the child, but of course that's impossible properly to police. Society has a role. And I like that philosophy. I like that ideology. But do I like this policy when you can't get the support you think you need to have a third child, but they can, by dint of being on lower incomes than you? I don't know. I'm just putting it out there. Shaquille's in Bexley. Shaquille, what would you like to say?
Hi there, James. First time caller.
Thank you.
Big fan of the show.
Welcome.
And yourself.
Good man.
So I actually work with, I'm actually a debt consultant. I work with people who are in debt, who are behind on their rent, on the council tax, on the water bills. And I see a lot of people who are on universal credit who are receiving PIP. And I feel like the reason why a lot of the 59% of people who are for the cap, the reason why they think that is because they think, oh, these guys are receiving free housing from the council and they're getting all these benefits. And they're basically, you know, essentially they think that these guys are undeserving of that. They're just lazy, which is not the case.
John's been in touch. He says, if you can't feed them, don't breed them. That's the attitude you're talking about.
Essentially, yeah, but obviously, so like an example I can give you is I spoke to someone last week who literally, she's a single mother, she's got three young kids, and she's left her old household with her partner, which is a domestic violence case. She's been abused. She left that situation, got housing from the council in another part of the UK where she's not, you know, familiar with. She's on universal credit, but what she's receiving from universal credit, and even I think one of the child's receiving DLA, and despite all of that, she's still not able to just manage her water bill,
yeah,
and her council tax. And it's not out of will or out of her not wanting to. It's essentially because of the situation and circumstance that she finds herself in.
I'm losing the phone line. The problem is, I suppose, that, and this is where David Blunkett is quite interesting, that identifying people that really, really need it is preferable to giving it to everybody who fits into a certain threshold. Do you see what I mean? I mean, you're describing a clear case of someone who needs it and doesn't get it. But by introducing it for everybody with a third child or more who is currently on universal credit, you do open up, I think, a lot of valid grievances.
I mean, I think it comes down to...
I'm going
to
give up on that phone line, Shaquille. Thank you for your kind words at the top of the show. It's not your fault, nothing to do with you. The technology is against us. I mean, the response to John's point is if you can't feed them, don't breed them. It comes nicely from Karen, who's keeping up the poetic theme, and she says, we need them, so breed them. And that is missing from this whole conversation, is the demographic madness that's on the horizon in this country, turning it into a place that people won't want to come to because we are making it clear that they are so unwelcome while having fewer children than ever before. And if that figure's correct from Alan, and he said he got it off Alistair Campbell, so who could possibly doubt its accuracy? It used to be 20 people being born per pensioner, and now it's 3. You can't sustain that indefinitely. You need people to have more children. But by focusing the help and support for people to have more children on people on universal... I don't know. I hope I'm not sounding snobbish or judgmental, but it just feels to me that... there's two angles to it, isn't there? There's the tackling child poverty, and child poverty exists more among people on universal credit than it does among people who aren't. Families on universal credit are going to be hosts to a lot more poverty than families who are not on universal credit. So don't see it, as I'm framing it at the moment, as almost an incentive or the removal of an obstacle to having a third child. See it instead as a policy designed to look after people who most need looking after, namely children in the poorest households who are already here. How can you be opposed to that? If you're opposed to this policy, genuine question, are you in favour of child poverty? 03456060973. What do we want? More child poverty. When do we want it now? David's in Wimbledon. David, what would you like to say?
Hi, firstly, I'm a first-time caller. Thanks for having me on your show.
Very well.
I think my first point would be, I think John's comments were quite outrageous in the sense that many, many people, and the majority, have children for the right reason and may enter financial difficulty at some point bringing their children up, and they should be supported. So the point of don't have them if you can't feed them, I think, is a pointless argument. But
argument, but it'd get you a job on the Daily Mail, so you can't blame John for parroting it.
But my main point is, I think limiting child benefit to 2 children exacerbates the risk of what is our real problem, which is our declining birth rate, which I think, from memory, is about 1.41 per couple. So we have a declining birth rate, and we have demographic challenges, and these would have long-term consequences for our economy, the workforce, and our public services. And I think you're right, it's about supporting the children. And yes, there are people who are parents who take advantage of child benefit to meet their own needs and desires of things and items that they want. But those are very small, and I think where schools and social services see that type of thing happen, then they should be identified and there should be some clear recourse mechanism to ensure the money is used appropriately.
You could do it the other way around, as David Blunkett suggests, which is working a little bit harder to identify the people who need it most.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's not just children in poor families that suffer. You know, there are wealthy parents who actually make their children live in challenging circumstances too. So it's not just poor children from poor families that have challenges. There are children for various circumstances also where there might be money in the family, actually they're not on the receiving end of it.
It's different in Scotland already. There's another child payment in Scotland, £27.15 per child for low-income families, every child under 16, just to help with food, clothing and school supplies. I think, and you're nailing this better than I've managed to, there is a sense, isn't there, in our society, and it's been very carefully cultivated by the kind of people who give millions of pounds to political parties and mysteriously end up with contracts to provide PPE that they've never been in the business of providing before. And their friends in the media create an idea that being poor is a lifestyle choice. It's your fault if you're poor. It's your fault if you haven't got any money. And the leap from that to, well, I don't care about the child. I don't care about the child who's hungry or the child who's not got, shoes that fit, or the child that's going to school or the child that's cold when they get in. I don't care about that because it's somehow their fault.
Completely. There are many, many people who work extremely hard who just happen to be on very low income. And I think the 60,000, if you're trying to bring up two children, certainly in the area that I live, on £60,000 and expect to bring them up in an absolutely amazing lifestyle where you could afford maybe a summer holiday, I think it's you know, it's very, very challenging for many, many people. And it's not because they don't work hard. It's because maybe, you know, like you said, if you look back through their childhood, you know, there's been challenges, or maybe they just haven't been quite as lucky. You know, there are many people who work hard and see the receipts of those, and there are some people who have just been a little bit more fortunate. And I think, but to your point, children don't choose to be born, you know, and they should be supported.
Yes, and how then do you, because you've clearly given this quite a lot of thought, how do you, and I know that, you know, a payment of £3,513 isn't going to be the big difference between having another child and not having a child, because if you're on that sort of financial knife edge, then the childcare costs are going to be a bigger factor than pretty much anything else, particularly if you're both working. And of course, it's perfectly possible to be in a working household and be on universal credit. It's surprisingly common. But if I were to say to you, I would like to have another child, but I genuinely can't afford it, and yet those people over the road who are on universal credit are getting £3,500 a year for their third child, which will make the difference. Am I wrong to get stuck on this? Am I sounding a bit lazy? It just seems to me, if I'm trying to get in the mind of somebody who isn't selfish but is part of the 59% of respondents who don't want this policy to be lifted, who like the cap. Is it a bit like that old chestnut about I got mugged last night, so I won't be happy until you're mugged as well? You get it with pensions. I've told you this a million times. Sitting in a studio back when I used to do paper reviews and the like. I wonder if you can guess what programme I turned down last night to discuss the travails of the BBC and Donald Trump. But sitting in one of those studios, listening to someone talk about how the public sector didn't deserve decent pensions because in the private sector they'd all been taken away. And I remember thinking, well, that's mad. That way would none of us ever have anything. It's like a Dutch auction, if that's the correct phrase, a race to the bottom. Is it the same? If you can't afford to have a third child, then there's something that feels like natural injustice about people who are poorer than you deciding that they can. I don't know. It's 10:46.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
I kept trying to say over and over again that the Tories left cuts of some £20 billion to public services. All of this was out there, all of this was available to see, and Labour deliberately closed their eyes to it, said that they were going to grow the economy and that they weren't going to increase income tax, national insurance or VAT. They knew that that was going to be a promise they would be hard-pressed to keep, if at all.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
It's easy to forget just how crazy things have been over the past couple of years. Every day we wake up to something new. Tariffs and taxes on anything and everything. It's tempting to put your hands in your ears and go la 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 la, I can't hear you, until it's all over. But you know what's the best response to crazy times? A plan for your money. And Quilter can help. Because let's face it, there's probably going to be some crazy times ahead too. Money needs a plan. Quilter. Pensions, investments, advice. Find out more at quilter.com.
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future, with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line, already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth Line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging. Or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep. Where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Ah, much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters. On your doorstep. Based on 2024 UK and EU Amazon packaging data.
The £5 meal deal from McDonald's. Get a cheeseburger or mayo chicken, medium fries, 4 McNuggets, and a medium soft drink for guess what? That's right. £5. It's not called the £5 meal deal for nothing. From 11 a.m. Not available on delivery. Carbonated soft drink upgrade fees apply. Participating restaurants subject to availability.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
10:49 is the time. I think I know why this is a popular policy, why the two-child benefit cap is a popular policy. And unlike some issues where the word poverty appears, I don't see it in quite as binary a fashion as I do other issues, because of people like this. People who are genuinely postponing parenthood until they're on a firmer financial footing, and whether rightly or wrongly, they feel that people who are earning less than them, or indeed not in work at the moment, getting £3,500 for a third child, in addition to the £7,000 they get per year for the first two, they feel an injustice there and an unfairness. So this is very much the personal versus the political. So on a political level, of course, society should be helping these children who, quotes, didn't ask to be born, end quotes. But on a personal level, you're getting up every morning, and the mythical or the proverbial or even the actual neighbour over the road isn't. And you can't, you're barely making ends meet. You certainly can't afford to have another child on top of the two that you've already got. But if you had £3,500 a year more, would you really? Would that be the thing? I'm also fascinated by the number of people currently with two children, whether they're on universal credit or not, who deeply and passionately want more, but feel that they can't. And this is an amazing message from Anthony, which is going to divide us all right down the middle. You're either going to nod along or you're going to go, what the fudge? Listen to this. I have four kids. I've never factored in whether I could afford them or not. That seems to me to utterly devalue human life. I can afford it right now. Maybe I won't be able to in 5 years. You can't live your life based on whether you can afford things. There are no guarantees either way. I mean, you have to live your life based on whether you can afford things, you flump, in many ways. Like, you're not going to go out and buy a Rolls Royce, are you? Well, you're not going to be allowed to. You're not going to go out and spend all your money for food this month on a nice new suit from Versace or something like that. But I do take your other point about family. Periods in history where you didn't have the luxury of wondering whether or not you could afford to have another baby, before contraception became commonplace. Birth control is a huge factor in this conversation. I've got 48 children and we're just going to muddle through. We're just going to... infant mortality was another reason why people had lots and lots of children. I almost envy Anthony's psychology to have that kind of almost laissez-faire attitude to some of the stuff that keeps the rest of us awake at night. So why? Why is a policy designed to eradicate or reduce child poverty so unpopular? Answer, because I'm not getting any help. Is it that simple? Are we back to selfishness? David's in Putney. David, what would you like to say?
Hi, Ian. So, I think...
Ian.
I get it.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, of course it is. You take your time, mate. Call me whatever you want. So, but within reason. Within Ofcom regulations.
Within regulation. Yes. So, I'm on Universal Credit, and we're expecting our second right now.
Okay.
And... I get it. I get why people feel this type of way about the child benefit and then the two-child benefit cap. I understand that, but I don't understand the judgment made by the demonization of people on universal credit, because it's not like there's this make-or-break amount when you have kids. It's you kind of spend as much money as you can on them, because that's where the money that you get goes at the end of the day.
Yes.
And I'm not out here going on summer holidays. I'm not living my best life. I'm just getting through, because I spend all of my days in full-time care of my wife and care of my son, because I don't really have much else to provide for society. I am...
Except another member of society.
Future generation.
The future contributor too. So that's a really helpful perspective that I hadn't really thought of before.
I'm just trying my best to raise someone who will really help society. And I don't mean in this altruistic sense. No. I just mean someone who feels better than I am right now. Someone who is better. I'm so sorry about my son. He's not well.
But... Hey, why are you apologising? That's one of the most wonderful sounds in the world. A happy child.
I cried when I got Universal Credit, when it started for me. I cried because it was such a painful experience to feel humiliated by the fact that everybody around me just didn't seem to appreciate what Universal Credit gave. They were demonizing people on social benefits. And it was really upsetting to start to receive it. And my friends had to tell me to stop being so pathetic when I was crying about getting it.
Oh, he is a bit poorly, isn't he? I won't detain you unduly, but it occurs to me that one way of addressing the people who say you shouldn't have another child because you can't afford it would be to say, I'm not having a child, I'm growing an adult.
Yeah, pretty much. I don't have much else value to society. I have a university degree that I can't use. I'm wanting to use it, but I physically cannot do that because I'm taking care of my wife, who is very unwell. I am taking care of.
And what should society do for and with a family like yours? Should it consign you to a life of childlessness? Should it tell you that these are the rules by which you must live, or should it just help? I don't know. A conversation would shift slightly in the context of the current policy if you were about to have your third child as opposed to your second, but the point still stands, doesn't it? Having the second child when the £3,513 is available is the same challenge as having the third, in a way. I hadn't thought of it like that. Thank you, David. And be a bit, if you'd allow me to say this, try to be a bit kinder to yourself. You're doing important and difficult work, and to have that sense of worthlessness around it is horrible to hear, because it's so obviously not the case. And that little lad will benefit from all of the efforts you're making, and all of the good that you're putting into him will, as you remind us, come out one day. It's not about having a child that you can't afford. It's about growing an adult that society needs. Rachel's in York with the last word on this, because I want to observe the 2 minute silence shortly, and that's one of the things you can't really be late for in this job. Rachel, what would you like to say?
Hi, I called. I haven't spoken to you in quite a while. Spoken to you once before.
Okay.
I completely respect your opinion and your, you know, views on everything. I personally was one of those people. I had a fantastic job. I had 3 children. I could pay for all of their childcare, you know, buy a house, all of those kinds of things.
Yes.
I was also in a domestic violence relationship.
Oh.
And I didn't become disabled, and we didn't know that our 3 children were disabled until after the youngest was born.
Right.
So I ended up having to not only get out of that relationship, but also give up my career. So now I am that person.
Gosh.
You know,
what would you have been like before on a phone in like this? Where would you have been on this kind of conversation if you can answer that question?
Personally, I've always been very socialist.
Okay.
Leaning, because,
well, that's no use to me. I wanted to have a big road to Damascus moment, Rachel. Go on.
However, that £3,500 that you're stuck on, and I've only called because I respect you so much.
Sorry.
When you work that out at £67 a week.
Yeah.
That's not really going to benefit anyone. There's no way. I know. With my tight budget, I couldn't possibly afford to feed, house, clothe, bathe, pay for a bus fare to school for any child on £67 a week.
No, thank you. I should have said that. Next time I'll say that.
Middle class couple with plenty of money are thinking that, you know, well, I can't, if I had £3,500, I could have another child. They couldn't.
That is the point. I kind of realised at about 5:30, but I didn't, you're right, I didn't go all in on it, and I needed you just to remind us of why that is a bogus argument. Not silly necessarily, because the number is originally arresting, but break it down, divide it by 52, and you get a much clearer picture of how pertinent it should be to all of these conversations. A lot of love coming in for the caller before you as well, Rachel, which I would add my voice to as well. Well, I tried at the time, but that seems to have chimed with a lot of you. It is today Armistice Day, and in a moment we will join the nation in pausing for 2 minutes to mark the moment fighting ended in the First World War and remember all those who've died for their country in battle since. Philip is a World War II veteran and has told us who he thinks of during the silence.
Those people who didn't live to enjoy the comradeship that, you know, that we have had over the years, all those people who didn't survive.
Nicky Scott is the founder of Scotty's Little Soldiers, a charity that supports bereaved military children and young people. She lost her husband, Lee, in 2009 while on tour in Afghanistan and spoke to us on Remembrance Sunday.
It's being with all the military, it's seeing the public, like, lining the streets, wearing their poppies. It just means that people still remember the sacrifice that your loved one and your family have gone through. And it just feels like the support of the country is behind you on this day.
At the 11th hour, on the 11th day of the 11th month, we will remember them.
A 2 minute silence to mark Armistice Day, remembering those who lost their lives during the First World War and conflict since. Also in today's headlines, the BBC's outgoing Director General says he supports journalists at the organisation after Donald Trump threatened to sue them. Tim Davies spoke to reporters outside the BBC's London headquarters this morning. An independent commission has found the UK's Prevent programme needs a radical overhaul. It says the current definition of terrorism is too broad and the wider counter-terror strategy is not fit for purpose. And the UK's unemployment rate has risen to the highest level since 2020. The latest data from the Office for National Statistics shows it hit 5% in the 3 months to September. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 81 points at 98.69. The pound buys $1.32 and €1.14. LBC weather, rain spreading to the north and west of the UK, but staying dry and bright in the south and east. Highs of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom at 4LBC, I'm Lottie Morley.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It is 3 minutes after 11 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Thank you for that. That was a good conversation, wasn't it, about something that we probably should talk about a little more. And as with all the best conversations that we have together, I came away from it knowing and understanding a little bit more than I did going in. I wonder whether the next subject can possibly get filed under that prospect. I think we need to do something. And it's something that I probably should have done sooner. Well, I probably have done it, actually. I can't tell other people to be kinder to themselves without taking my own advice sometimes. But it's happened again. If you do even the cursory research into a lot of the individuals who are behind the proliferation of flags that have appeared on lampposts, often dangling from a single cable tie up and down the country, many of which are now, as was inevitable, looking, many of them are now past their best. If you look at the people behind these, and some wonderful local news organisations have actually been doing the digging into it. I'm very excited by this new sort of self-generated journalism. There's one, I must get you the names of them, and double-check that they've done the work on these, because I get them all a bit mixed up in my head. But they track down the people behind these schemes, many of whom, of course, are accepting donations, some of whom have appeared on so-called television stations. And it's pretty clear what's going on. It is in some cases unlikely that the taxman is going to be unduly troubled by the rather large sums of money that have been generated on Facebook and elsewhere. But the ease and speed with which you can accuse somebody who doesn't like seeing these flags, and of course the tattier they are, the less attractive they become. The speed and ease with which you can accuse them of everything from not being patriotic to not respecting our dead soldiers is both violent and deliberate. It is designed to frighten you. That response to questioning why we have to have tatty flags dangling from lampposts without being consulted, asked, or approving. Why, if it happens to be on your street and you want to take it down, you're likely to come in for abuse if the people who are putting it up were to stumble across your efforts. It's a very deliberate thing. And of course, what you do if you're either cowardly... Let me rephrase that. That's not fair. What you do if it's worked... What you do if the intimidation has worked is you repeat endlessly, well, not all people who like the flags are intimidating, that not all people who like the flags are trying to make people frightened, not all people who like the flags are, why can't you like the flag? We should all honour the flag. That's what you do if it's worked, if the intimidation has worked. That because they are intrinsically linked. I will bet you my bottom dollar that a lot of the people who put these flags up were desperately hoping that councils would take them down again so that they could get on their high horse, probably get an appearance on GBBs, get patted on the head by Nigel Farage and pose looking cross and patriotic in their local paper. They were desperately hoping to create negativity. And it failed, oddly. Whether or not there should have been a more measured response, whether or not people should have pointed out, as has subsequently become clear, that the health and safety issues posed by these tatty flags will possibly prevent Christmas lights being put up. Why do these people hate Christians? You wonder, as you see people putting up flags that may curtail or dilute the celebration of Christmas itself. But it worked. The terrorizer, and it's partly because of what Twitter has become. So that you are not allowed to have an opinion that is uncomfortable to people who want to intimidate others. And it's not just about intimidating people on the streets where the flags fly. It's also about intimidating people who question whether or not this is actually a truly admirable act of patriotism, or whether it's an act of aggression or an act of vulgarity. I felt quite moved by the flags that I saw on Sunday. This is going to sound a little bit holier than thou, but on my way to church, I saw a curious combination of flags, some of which were being used to mark Remembrance Sunday. There was a little ceremony. They closed off the street at the end of my road, and there was a gathering of veterans and a ceremony. You know what a ceremony is. You don't need me to draw you a picture. And it was accompanied by some flags, as you would expect. But also in the environs of that area, that there are flags dangling from lampposts held there with a sort of single cable tie. It was hard to clarify, but one of them was perhaps upside down, which is, of course, disrespectful in and of itself. And I was really struck by the contrast between the flag being used to commemorate our war dead on Remembrance Sunday and the flag being put up without any permission, consultation or agreement by the people who live there, being put up in the middle of the night in a clumsy and ugly fashion and left there to sort of rot on the street. And I found myself wondering whether or not I would come on air today and talk about this. Well, I saw the story this morning about NHS staff expressing, feeling intimidated. That's the point. They're meant to feel intimidated. We all are meant to feel intimidated, unless we subscribe to the idea that if you're not white, you're not British, or you're not white, you're not English. That's the point. It is not a coincidence that these flags started appearing at precisely the point that public discourse started accommodating the idea that if you're not white, you're not British, or if you're not white, you're not English. It is not a coincidence. Think of them as two parts of the same process. And of course, the proliferation of the flags empowered people like Honest Bob Jenrick and Katie Lamb and the rest of them to talk about how they felt regarding people that aren't like them. The cultural coherence in Lamb's case, or the non-white faces on the streets of Handsworth in Honest Bob Jenrick's case, or that hideous reform woman who doesn't like seeing brown people in adverts. It goes hand in hand. And if you think I'm exaggerating, where do you think those people stand on the flags? So where do you think the woman driven mad by adverts featuring Frank Bruno would sit on the spectrum of support our flags? Funny, I wonder how many people who revere the tatty flags that have been put up on our streets are opposed to the lifting of the two-child benefit cap. Let's make life better for the most vulnerable British children. No, down with that sort of thing. Let's put up flags in the dead of night and scream at anybody who objects. Yes, yes, hallelujah. Rule Britannia. So it's important not to be terrorised. It's important not to be intimidated by a programme that has got its roots in precisely the same soil as the increasingly commonplace calls to deny Britishness or Englishness to people of colour. It just is. And whether or not you are on the same page as the false patriots putting the flags up, or whether or not you are just a little bit frightened of the violent response you will get when you say that this honours nobody, this celebrates nothing, this is of a piece with public discourse descending to a place where you can accuse people of not being British, you can tell them that they shouldn't be here. People frightened by the knowledge that they will be attacked for expressing that view. Therefore, they don't express it. So, as I read this morning about some of these flags creating no-go zones for NHS staff, health leaders describing frequent abuse felt or endured by staff visiting patients, intimidation felt as a consequence of the emblems themselves. Senior managers found 77% concerned about discrimination towards NHS staff from patients and the public. Wes Streeting has recently warned or described the ugly comeback of 1970s style racism. And the flags, one health leader has said, we saw during the time when the flags went up, our staff, who are a large minority of black and Asian staff, feeling deliberately intimidated. It felt like the flags were up, creating no-go zones. That's what it felt like to them. I have been into homes with people who have been convicted of sex offences, and we go in and provide care to them. It can be a really precarious situation, and they handle the They handle that absolutely brilliantly, just describing the difficulties of being a frontline healthcare worker. But talking about feeling intimidated and adding, and this is the point, I think that's what it was designed to feel like in many cases. So do I become part of the problem that I've described when I say not in all cases? Not in all cases. And I'm talking about the recent proliferations. I'm not talking about the lovely old fella up the road who plays the bugle and raises a flag every Sunday morning. I'm not talking about the flag in and of itself. I'm talking about the proliferation of often cheap and soon to be tatty flags being hung in the dead of night from lampposts up and down the land. And I'm asking you, well, I'm telling you, I think it is designed to be intimidated. And if I was under any doubt whatsoever about that, then just a cursory look at who is behind some of the bigger programs to do it would absolutely confirm that it is designed to be intimidated. I don't think it is a coincidence that it has happened at exactly the same time that public conversation has lurched back into an Enoch Powell-shaped time warp and started discussing whether or not black people should be in adverts or indeed can be British. And those people put up those flags to make that point. I think we really need to be honest about it. Keir Starmer, as is his wont, absolutely bottled it. Keir Starmer, as is his wont these days, absolutely failed to stand up for what is right, describing himself as liking flags. That's a stupid thing to say. We all like flags, potentially. Depends where they are and what is being done with them. You wouldn't like a flag if somebody had rolled it into a thing, stuck it in the freezer until it's solid and then smashed you over the head with it. It's a stupid thing to say, I like flags. Do you like flags when the National Front are waving them? Do you like flags when football hooligans are waving them before launching petrol bombs at each other on the street outside the stadium back in the day? I like flags. Is it? I believe it is. Let me be absolutely clear, because I think perhaps I've bottled this myself in the past, because, you know, everybody's got a limit on how far above parapets they want to stick their heads. And the people who want to be pushed back against, the people who want to hear voices saying, these flags aren't patriotic, these flags honour nobody, these flags aren't even adorning our streets, these flags are a menace. You know it's true, but you're frightened of saying it because of the violence of the response. It's one of the great advantages of coming off Twitter, actually, is that you don't see it and you won't hear it. Politicians are frightened of it. Ordinary people are frightened of it. Commentators, I hope, are frightened of it, because the alternative, of course, is to actually agree with the intimidation, to support the intimidation. But they are designed to be intimidating, aren't they? Hit the numbers now, you will get through. 0345 6060 973. An NHS leader has described his conviction that staff can feel intimidated. We know that because they tell us. And in many cases, I think that's what it was designed to feel like. Do you think the people behind these flags, the people loudest in their support of these flags, are trying to intimidate people? 0345 6060 973. And look, tell me I'm wrong, but you'll have to tell me why. Don't, for example, ring in and say, what about Palestine flags? Or ring in and say, for example, well, what about my great uncle's flag out the clock tower of his stately home? Just talk to me about the recent proliferation of flags and tell me whether or not you think they are designed to be intimidated, because I'm absolutely certain of it. And my certainty has been compounded by the slightly belated realization that it's the visual equivalent of Robert Jenrick complaining about brown faces in Handsworth, of Katie Lamb talking about cultural coherence as a reason for deporting people with every right to be here. It is the same, it's the visual equivalent of that hideous woman complaining about brown people being in adverts or black people being in adverts. It's exactly the same process. except they use their words and get awards from the Spectator magazine as a consequence, whereas those who don't have big platforms, they just use the flags to make exactly the same point. There's too many black people in adverts. Let's stick a flag on a lamppost. We should be deporting people who don't look like us. Let's stick a flag on a lamppost. I couldn't walk down the street in Birmingham. I didn't see another white face, and that's not the country I want to live in. Let's stick a flag on a lamppost. Go on. Tell me I'm wrong. 0345-6060973 is the number you need. It's 1119.
This is LBC.
To be honest, work had been a slog. I'm a designer, but some nights I was chasing invoices like my full-time job. Now Sage Copilot chases my invoices for me. I just need to click a button and it's done. And I get paid 1 week faster.
Sage Copilot is built with over 40 years of experience helping real businesses like Sophia at Solver Design. That's more than artificial intelligence, that's authentic intelligence. Search Sage Copilot to learn more. Working with 21 customers, each round payments came in 7 days faster with Sage Copilot. T's and C's apply.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. HolidayParkAdviceCentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
A message from TfL.
I saw him in the local news a few days after. His name was Rakesh. They had to put him into a coma just because I didn't look again at that turning. He had two kids. How did I not see his bike ahead of me? Well, I didn't look again. He didn't make it.
Drivers, take another look, not a life. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
It is 20 minutes after 11. I just read the circumstances in which you'd get a flag out. If you're on the Olympic podium having just... Excuse me, there's a little frog in the throat, but I think I've dealt with it. If I was on the Olympic podium having just received a gold medal, answers on a postcard as to what discipline I'm most likely to have received an Olympic gold medal in. I don't think talking qualifies. On Remembrance Sunday, when quite rightly we turn our attention to the national flag, plenty of other occasions I can think of, but in the middle of the night sticking one on a lamppost, regardless of whether or not the people who live in the house behind the lamppost want it there, that's not really very normal behaviour, is it? Why have we all become so frightened of saying so? That's question number two. Question number one, is it intimidating? Is it designed to be intimidating? Two slightly different questions. Question number three, why have we all become so frightened of saying so? If there were Sunny Delight adverts, no one would be quibbling about whether or not they were desirable. It's not about the flag, it's about the context of the flag. Tatty, Chinese-made tut, put there with cable ties. That doesn't honour anybody. And it's pathetic that it's taken me so long to recognise the absurdity of being frightened to criticise it and the reality of what is going on, unless I'm wrong. Julie's in Birmingham. Julie, what would you like to say?
I'm just ringing in to say I used to be proud. I used to like seeing the Union Jack or the flag of St George flying for sports events, etc. And now I hate seeing it. And it's such a shame. I live in Birmingham and I have to drive through King's Standing.
Right.
It is absolutely festooned with the flags. And I was talking to my daughter about it the other day with my 16-year-old granddaughter in the car.
Yeah.
And she said, are you talking about the racist flags? That is how a 16-year-old now perceives the Union Jack and the flag of St. George. And I think it is designed to intimidate. I was trying to buy a T-shirt because I used to wear a Union Jack T-shirt. It's gone in the bin.
Yes.
Because I don't want people looking at me and thinking I'm racist, because I'm absolutely not. I would like to buy a T-shirt with the Union Jack, and every country where we've got people from those countries living in this country have their flag on it as well. Something that says, this isn't for me as a British person. I'd like to fly the Union Jack. I'm wearing a poppy today. I wear it with pride. My son served. and lost friends in the Afghan war.
Yeah.
And I'm proud to be British. I'm not proud of the Union Jack anymore.
And it's as a consequence of this summer?
Yes. Yes, and they said in King Standing, oh, we've done this to support our soldiers. There was not one flag about supporting the troops. There is now, some have now gone up. But then, when you looked on the Facebook post, one of the hashtags was send the boats back or something, or stop the boats. And I thought, well, that's got nothing to do with the soldiers.
Why? I mean, I don't know that this actually applies to you, Julie, but it will apply to a lot of other people. Why? Why are so many of us so frightened to say what is so obvious?
They don't know who they're saying it to. They don't know what the reaction can be. Violence these days throughout the country. You can say the wrong thing to the wrong person and get slapped, stabbed. You know, people are just afraid to confront them. But
And is there any case in which we could rethink? It's not, is it? It's all about the context. It's not about a flag. It's about the circumstances in which they're hung up, the hashtags that are attached to them, the identity of the people that are doing it, slowly being unmasked and unearthed by journalists, not working largely for right-wing newspapers, and the knowledge of what they are designed to do. They go hand in hand with the kind of rhetoric that's telling people if they're black they can't be British, like Robert Jenrick essentially fed into when he turned up in your city and claimed that it represented a country he didn't want to live in.
Yeah, I just feel like it's been hijacked by racists. That's how I feel. And, yeah, I won't wear it, the Union Jack anymore.
I think that's really sad. You think it's really sad as well. As the mother of a military veteran, that's your flag, and yet you feel it's been stolen from you. That's the point.
Absolutely.
And I mean, you deal with that. You tell the mother of a military veteran while you're shinning your way up a lamppost in the middle of the night that you are somehow representing her son's fallen comrades by making her feel that she can't put the flag on anymore without somehow being perceived as having joined your nativist bilge and bile. Elaine's in Market Harbour. Elaine, what would you like to say?
Hi, good morning, James. This morning I was out walking my dog, and there's a chap who lives nearby, has a flag hanging out of his window, and he's had it there for the last, I would say, three months now.
Okay.
It's really galled me, because Market Harbour is actually quite a lovely town. And I saw him this morning, and I asked him, I said, just out of curiosity, I said, why have you got the flag hanging out of your house? And he became instantly aggressive with me, and his undertone, before he used to say hello to me on
really?
A dog walk. And yes, and I didn't really speak to him. I just kind of go, hi.
Morning.
But obviously, he never actually, yes, absolutely. He never really heard my accent before. Now, I was born in the UK. I have a British passport. And long story short, I have found quite a lot of racism since Brexit. The day I voted for in the referendum, I was told outside the school where I was voting, I bet you're voting to stay in because you'll be scared you'll be chucked out. Now, that was the day of the referendum. This morning I asked him why he had the flag there. He instantly became aggressive with me and said, I'm British, I have a right to hang the flag out. And in Market Harbour currently, we have lots of flags out, but they're for Remembrance Sunday and to remember all of the troops. And then he said, well, what's the difference with hanging all the flags in Market Harbour? And I said, that's very different. That's to do with Remembrance Sunday and remembering the fallen. And he just came so toxic and aggressive to me. And there's a lady who lives around the corner from his house. He's Ghanaian. And we cried around 3 months ago when he hung that flag out, because it's just so unsettling. It's just awful.
And what you're doing, what people are doing, is very, very deliberately pretending that you are upset by the flag rather than the circumstances in which it has been tacked onto a windowsill and dangled out of a first floor bedroom in Market Harbour.
100%. 100%.
So they'll pretend. So how dare you denigrate our flag? In fact, you're the ones denigrating our flag.
Yes.
You're the ones denigrating our flag by cable tying it halfway up a lamppost because your B&Q stepladder won't reach any higher. You're denigrating our flag.
Well,
you're robbing our last caller of the right to wear the flag under which her son marched to war. And he wanted that reaction. He's probably hoping every day someone will come past and give him the opportunity to inflate his pathetic personality with bogus patriotism by making arguments he can't sustain.
James, I could see how uneducated the guy was, so I actually just thought to myself, don't waste your breath, Elaine, on this.
I'm up for a fight, and you decided not to give it to him. But, you know, it's my right to fly the flag. Okay, I mean, we've got lots of rights. You don't have to exercise them. Context versus content, absolutely crucial in this case. Thank you, Elaine. And it is circumstances. It's not intimidating at all, says someone who's not intimidated by it. That is, forgive me, that's a really silly argument. It's not intimidating at all, says someone who it's not designed to intimidate. unravel it in a way that's less... explain to the lovely lady in Birmingham why she shouldn't feel that the flag has once again been stolen from decent people. Stolen by the National Front in the 1970s, stolen by... did they call it Raise the Colours in 2025? And just look at it. Do the most cursory research, the most half-baked Googling, especially if you do what I do for a living. Just have a little look at who has been behind the larger campaigns to do this kind of thing. And your conclusions will be inarguable. It is 11:29, and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Why are we frightened of saying it, do you think? Stating the obvious. Flags on Remembrance Sunday are beautiful and honourable emblems. Flags halfway up a lamppost in the middle of the night on a wet August Thursday honours nobody, celebrates nothing, intimidates many. Lottie Morley has your headlines.
The Queen is attending a service at Paddington train station in London to mark Armistice Day. People around the world have commemorated the end of World War I with a two-minute silence. The outgoing Director General says he's proud of BBC journalists after Donald Trump threatened to sue them for $1 billion. Tim Davey has been speaking to staff at the organisation after criticism of editing choices led him to resign. And the government has set out its first ever strategy to bring an end to animal testing. The RSPCA says it welcomes it cautiously. LBC weather, a wet and windy day for most of the UK, with rain spreading towards the north and west. Another mild day with highs of 16 degrees.
LBC.
Managing your business is a big task. To then stay on top of the numbers as well, you're only human. That's why the Intuit QuickBooks AI-powered platform supports your business growth as the number one recommended cloud accounting software. Intuit QuickBooks. Based on a survey of 506 UK accounting professionals. Verify at quickbooks.co.uk/verify.
It's that time of year again, which can only mean one thing. Save a third off roasting joints at Waitrose. Choose from tender beef silverside, succulent whole brined and seasoned chicken, or juicy beach smoked gammon. So, fire up your ovens and give winter a warm welcome with a third off roasting joints. Waitrose, the home of food lovers.
Selected lines and stores subject to availability. Prices may vary in Channel Islands, Little Waitrose in Partners and Concessions. Offer ends 11th of November.
For anyone needing assistance when travelling with TfL, such as people with visual or mobility impairments, our Turn Up and Go service has staff on hand to help. It's available at all London Underground, London Overground and Elizabeth Line stations, and there's no need to book. Just turn up and go. That is how we're making the greener way to travel more accessible to all. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
This year, Amazon are increasing the electric delivery vehicles we use across Europe to 10,000. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where babies are made a fuss of. Where we deliver footballs for kids' kickabouts. And where they deliver the football straight into next door's garden. Can they have their ball back, please? We're delivering change where it matters. On your doorstep. Delivery service partner vehicles across the UK and EU.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 60 60 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
33 minutes after 11, so if you need me to do it for you, that's fine. The places where you can find some quite brave, actually, given the very deliberate intimidation brought to bear on anybody criticising these flags that have started appearing up and down the country, to the point now where NHS staff feel intimidated as they visit patients in their homes. There's a rather splendid local news, it's a sort of online newspaper called The Dispatch in Birmingham, D-I-S-P-A-T-C-H. Have a look at that. They've looked into it. A similar operation in Birmingham, in Manchester, called The Mill. That's done a very similar investigation. In fact, they've got publications across the country at Mill Media. They've done a very similar investigation into, quotes, the men who raised the flags. Our friends at Hope Not Hate have identified several former members of the EDL, including one man who had previously been jailed for his part in a racist death, both putting up the flags and encouraging people to give them money so that they can continue to do so. And while it's perfectly possible that they've all of the people identified in these reports, in these investigations, have undergone road to Damascus-style conversions and are now dedicated to peace, harmony and brotherly love, it seems unlikely. So, can anyone meaningfully argue that they are not designed to be intimidating? And, actually, that answers the second question. Why are people frightened of speaking up against them? Answer, because they don't want to be intimidated. They don't want to be attacked. Not least, they don't want to get into the bad books of somebody who's been jailed for taking part in a racist death. And there it is. Mystery over. Unless you can tell me otherwise. Lisa is in Faversham in Kent. Lisa, what would you like to say?
Hello, James. Very nervous.
It's only me.
Mainly because, actually, well, it relates to some of the intimidation that people aligned against these people have experienced in our town. We've had all of this. We've had the flags being put up repeatedly across the town. What I wanted to just mention to you particularly,
yes,
part of a much bigger story, but where are local ninjas, who are our people who take down the flags very quickly in some cases, have been able to remove them, and where local people have openly opposed these people putting up the flags, they've then been targeted again for what the flaggers call double flagging. So they will go and put up two flags outside somebody who's opposed them previously. There's a
who does that honour?
Well,
I don't know.
Their own egos.
That's a good point, actually. Yes.
Well, there's actually a road in Faversham that the flaggers have dubbed Lefty Lane, because there are numerous people there who have stuck their necks out and opposed these people. I'm not going to go into some of the other ways that they've been intimidated,
okay,
but those are some specific examples of how the flags themselves have been used to intimidate. But yeah, I mean, on a very positive note, Faversham has been really amazing as a community in coming together to remove these flags. Sometimes they don't even see the light of day. They're put up at kind of 10 o'clock by flaggers, and by dawn they're removed and streets are flag free. And we've been really, well, I say the deflaggers or ninjas have been really, really good at doing that.
I'm cursed by a need to be generous, even in circumstances where generosity may not be needed. So, not talking about the people who put them up in the dead of night against the wishes of the people on whose street they are putting them up. That is,
right outside children's bedroom windows. Yeah,
very, very deliberately intimidating people who've expressed unhappiness about having anything put up on lampstands outside the house, particularly this flag at this time, at this sort of part of the historical cycle. So if I took a call now, or if I read a text out now from somebody who said, well, I don't mind them, I quite like them, that doesn't make them part of the problem that we're describing. It just means they haven't really been paying full attention.
No, that's absolutely true. And, you know, nobody, certainly I'm not aware of anybody in our town that would have any problem with people displaying these symbols on their own houses, on their own property, but placing them on roads where they've been actively opposed and then targeting those roads or those particular houses in some cases is just absolutely abhorrent.
It's like an animal putting down a scent, isn't it?
Exactly.
You're saying our roads. They're not your roads. They're not your roads. They're our roads.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whose roads are roads? Whose streets are streets? And particularly for people who... It's almost as if people have got bored of using the P word and the N word on Twitter now that Elon Musk lets them. So they've decided to carry the same sort of bile out onto the streets of Britain.
Absolutely. Just as a as an ironic kind of finishing point as well, the same group of people decided to put up flags in remembrance. Now, you can get these lovely flags from the Royal British Legion.
Yes.
Not for them, though. Not for them. They were bought in bulk from an online store that quite famously offshores its taxes. So something that could have been quite a popular community activity was actually still
managed. Did you know, it's probably because the story about the NHS leaders describing their staff feeling intimidated followed so fast upon Sunday morning, as I noted the contrast between the flags put up by these people you describe and I describe, and I read about many of them being ex-EDL and similar, and the flags properly marking the commemoration, which was, you know, a thing of importance and a thing of beauty. So Jason in Wimbledon's in Idiot's Corner this morning. That potentially could have put a lot of people in Idiot's Corner, but here you go. The biggest question I have is why you seem to hate everything English, from the full English breakfast to the flags and lots of things in between, asks Jason in Wimbledon. Why, James? Because I want the flag to be respected and revered at times of national importance and profundity, Jason, and I don't want it to be dangling deliberately from a lamppost outside the home of somebody who has asked for them not to put it up in the first place. I mean, it's a rhetorical question, but what on earth is hard to understand about that? Let's have a look at your history. Oh, you were in touch yesterday. I can't listen to you anymore, he said. Ah, how's that working out for you, pal? 24 hours later, here you are. Still chomping. You will do anything to win an argument, and I don't know if that is trustworthy anymore. I'd just stick to the flags if I were you and stop worrying about things like thoughts and arguments. We all have our strengths, pal. But honestly, I love a full English breakfast. I have merely pointed out in the past how ridiculous it is to describe a breakfast as patriotic. It's no more patriotic than a park bench. Absolutely ridiculous, but that was during the mad days of Brexit. Oh, I forgot to tell you. In fact, I think, wasn't it that person, David Frost, who described himself as having a patriotic breakfast during the Brexit negotiations that he, surprise, surprise, so signally messed up? If, of course, you want to entertain the notion that it was a better deal to be secured, then David Frost most definitely didn't do it. He's got a new job, and I forgot to tell you what it is. I wonder if you... let me give you a clue. The more closely you follow the things I explain on this programme, the sort of stuff Jason hates, because it makes him feel a bit silly, the more closely you follow my... I might call them obsessions, the easier it will be to work out how David Frost has just accepted what would be close to the perfect job for him to accept in the context of the madness that has corrupted our country. If you've read How They Broke Britain, for example, or you've just heard me regurgitate much of what's in its pages on this programme, what job in the British kind of ecosphere of... I'm not going to give you too many clues. What would be the one job that David Frost would take that would make me sit back, light a cigar and go, and you think I exaggerate this stuff? So a man who moved effortlessly from being passionately in favour of being in the European Union when he had a job that mattered to becoming Boris Johnson's negotiator-in-chief and put in the House of Lords for delivering the Brexit that everybody now complains about. What would his job be? I'm over-egging the pudding. See if you can work it out. 11:42 is the time. Connor is in Islington. Connor, what made you pick up the phone?
Hi, James. Hi, things.
Oh, good, mate. What's on your mind?
Listen, I think I spoke to Eleanor there. I don't know if anybody's brought this up before, but I think a comparison to Northern Ireland and specifically Belfast might be quite useful here. I grew up there for about 15 years. I grew up Catholic in a Protestant area, and it was very clear to me which were sort of no-go zones with the Northern Irish flag, the British flag, the Israeli flag, as many flags as you can imagine, for the loyalist side, and it's a demarcation, it's intimidation through a demarcation of territory.
No one would dispute that in the context of Northern Irish history, would they? Really? And it cuts both ways. No. I mean, you're going to have Republican flags in Catholic parts of town, aren't you?
Strangely not as much, for some reason. I'm not quite sure.
So that may be disputed by other listeners, which is fine, because you're going from your own memories. But it cuts both ways, exactly. is what I'm saying. Yeah. And if you have a sectarian status quo, then you will have demarcation of territory. And we don't have a sectarian status quo in this country. But when people talk about not wanting white brown faces on the telly, or not wanting to see brown faces on the streets of Birmingham, or wanting to deport people in order to pursue cultural coherence, they're flirting with sectarianism, or at least with sort of ethnic nationalism, aren't they?
Yeah, it was Jason's message that you read out just there, and you know, we can all sort of scoff and laugh, but I mean, these people, I do feel not compassion towards them, but these people are sort of looking for an outlet. They're putting these flags up, I think, because they feel threatened. They're being told by
some of them might be, but the former members of the EDL who are behind some of the biggest campaigns, and the people identified by the Dispatch in Birmingham and the Mill up in Manchester, these aren't people who deserve your concern or your compassion. They need to be resisted.
But I'm trying to understand them. I'm trying to understand them because I mean, it also. You know, this might be Belfast specific and anecdotal, but the intensity of the flags correlates to the level of poverty in Belfast.
And that's, you're right, of course, to remind us that the most fertile of ground for spreading this sort of division will be the people with the biggest grievances, or with the strongest sense of having been left behind or let down. And it is, of course, all the fault of black people in adverts, as opposed to the distribution of wealth inflicted upon them by successive right-wing governments and cheer-led to the rafters by precisely the kind of people in the media who pretend not to understand or not to see precisely what's going on with these flags. It's one of the oldest things in the playbook, isn't it? The best possible environment for racists and racist provocateurs to flourish in will be refugee crises and economic difficulties. We don't actually have a refugee crisis as such in the way that we've had in the past when, for example, Syria was on fire, but we do have a massive problem with people crossing the English Channel in small boats. Massive being a matter of opinion, of course. So you and who turned that into a subject of national importance? People desperate for refugee crises. You need to create the idea in the minds of people that they are under threat and losing something, while simultaneously ignoring the economic realities of why they are struggling financially. And then very easily you blame it all on people who don't look like them. And if you're really, really lucky, if things are really, really bad and the media is really, really bent, then you get very senior and frontline politicians like Robert Jenrick and Katie Lamb joining in. And that's where we are now. And the flags are an absolutely integral part of the process I've just described. That's not even an opinion. That's just counting.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
Why is there delay?
Straight to the point.
This government is unravelling everywhere you look.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
How can that make sense to anyone?
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line, already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
We had our smart meter installed a year ago, and it's made things so much easier.
Not having to submit meter readings or having to deal with estimated bills is great.
A smart meter sends meter readings direct to your energy supplier. It means you get accurate bills, not estimated bills, and you don't even need an internet connection. Call your energy supplier to request a smart meter today.
Real testimonials voiced by actors. Eligibility may vary.
Experience. It's knowing the difference between a good deal and, well, a great deal. Right now, get 3 months free when you take out Saga Health Insurance. You get 24/7 GP access whenever you want it. And the freedom to choose your preferred private hospital with your own room should you need it. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. New customers starting a policy before the 27th of November. Pay by monthly direct debit for the first year. Terms and conditions apply. Over 50s only.
Henry's best ever Black Friday sale is now on. And it doesn't get any better than this. With an extra 10% off absolutely everything. That's on top of up to 50% off hundreds of made-to-measure blinds, curtains and shutters. Plus, control your blinds from anywhere with a half-price smart hub when you buy any electric blind. With measuring and fitting always included. And word to the window wise. Order now for blinds and curtains fitted in time for Christmas. Book your free in-home appointment today at hillarys.co.uk. Conditions apply.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Oh, recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it, and there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
It's 11:49. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where I suppose the first question answers the second question, and I should have realised that before I asked you them both. So, are the flags that proliferate on our streets designed to be intimidating? And why are people frightened of saying so? Answer, because they're designed to be intimidating. And they're also, this is why that story about the Reform Council, revealing that they were going to have to take them down in order to put up the Christmas lights, or even that they wouldn't be able to put up the Christmas lights because the flags were in the way, was such a perfect story. Because I think a lot of people behind these schemes wanted them to be taken down so they could just scream and shout in the way that they can do on Twitter, and now are increasingly thinking they should be free to do in real life. I mean, it's absurd, really, to think that we honour our war dead by cable tying flags to lampposts without asking anybody in the area whether they want them there, or putting any scheme in place that's going to look after them or care for them. It is just absurd. But that's the thing, isn't it, about these sort of nativist urges, is that once you've taken the lid off the bottle and the genie is out, it's very hard to get back in. Do you know what? I really don't like those flags over there. I love those flags over there, the ones that are flying outside public buildings, or the ones that we raise and properly honour on Remembrance Sunday and similar other occasions. But covering lampposts in them, what's that all about? How dare you? Why do you hate England? Why do you hate this country? How dare... That's not what's going on here, lads, and you know it. You're here for a fight. I've spoken to the mother of a military veteran who feels that you've stolen her flag from her. Go on, tell her she's not patriotic. It's never been about honouring anybody or celebrating anything. It's always been about doing what your cat does to let the neighbourhood cats know that that's their garden. And that is, of course, of a piece with all the racism that has been increasingly mainstreamed in recent weeks and months. It just is. Is it? It's not even really, is it, a matter of debate, this? It just is. And if you're in the mood to tell me that it's not intimidating, then you can't. All you can say is, I'm not intimidated by it. You can't tell someone else they're not. Charlie's in Preston. Charlie, what would you like to say?
Hiya. Hello. I'm just, I just want to call because I thought I just have some conflicting opinions on it. Not conflicting opinions, but I said to the lady on the phone before that answered that I was on the fence. Not on the fence, but I can see some sides of it on both sides. Sure. There is the majority of the flag people, like you said, they're there to intimidate, you know, and I drive up the north of England a lot. I go to these old milling towns and they're everywhere. And I think there is a small majority that there is the national pride of the flag, and they've been shamed in the past for flying the flag, but I have a girlfriend, I have a fiancé, sorry, from British Virgin Islands, Caribbean, and yes. I messed up a bit there. And she made a good point the other day that when the South, everything kicked off in Southport,
yeah.
he said that these flags and the people that put the flags up, she was scared to go out at that time because even though she's got a British passport and she's a British citizen from the British Virgin Islands, some of these people aren't bothered, do you know what I mean? And the flags were put up, I find, at a time when there was a rise in boats coming across, especially yes. a few years ago. And there's a few hotels where they stay at in Blackpool and Preston near me, and there's an influx of flags around those specific areas.
Mm.
A lot of it's directed at that to intimidate.
Of course it is.
Intimidate them there. Now, I don't think that's the right way of going about it, but I can see people are scared about what's going on recently. But then I'm conflicted because, you know, you see all the stuff in the news, you see stuff on Twitter especially, because it's very, very biased now, Twitter. Don't know whether that's down to Elon Musk or what.
It is.
Yeah. But I play football on Wednesday for a Sunday league team on Sunday, and I train on Wednesday, and this lad came down. He's been coming down every day for a week to wait for someone to see if someone was playing football. And it turns out he was an illegal immigrant and he'd come over on a boat. And I saw him and I felt bad. Not felt bad for him, but, you know, I looked after him while he was with us.
Yeah. He wanted to get. He's an asylum seeker, is he?
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's in one of the hotels, repurposed hotels.
He's in housing in the town I live in. And he's a lovely lad. And I learned a lot about how he came here. You know, his parents unfortunately passed away.
Yeah.
From, I don't know, I didn't ask him why.
Sure.
But, you know, I learned a lot about him. And it really made me, you know, open my mind up a bit to the flags as well. And especially having that conversation with my fiance, because, you know, I'm going to have kids in the future. And I think if they come into this, world, mixed race, I think especially with what happened on the train the other day, that was a big point you made with those people that weren't from, well, they were born here, but they're skin colour, and everyone was saying that, oh, just because they were born here.
Doesn't mean they're British.
Yeah. And that was a big point. And it really opened my eyes because I thought, wow. You know, and it made me a bit worried for the future, for her, especially, because ever for the last year, all I've really, like I said, I've been on the fence, but I've been thinking in my point of view,
yes,
you know what I mean?
I do know exactly what you mean, and you're explaining it brilliantly.
And when I look at her, when she said that to me the other day, I was like, wow, maybe I need to, like, take a step back and really, like, look at the bigger picture.
Well, I wonder if what you've described is it's all about context, Charlie, because... What I've been at great pains to explain this morning is that the flag, the Union flag, the St. George's flag, can be powerful and wonderful things, particularly in the context, I think, of military service and remembrance, which we're doing today. But equally, they can be misused. They can be abused almost and denigrated when they're used to do some of the things that I think your girlfriend has perceived them as being used to do, and you've seen yourself outside some of the repurposed hotels, and we know that a lot of the people putting them up are very much the kind of if you like the public wing of the people on social media with bulldog avatars and 3,000 flags in their profiles. So two things can be true at the same time. That's why I was so upset. I don't know if you heard of the mother of the former soldier who felt that she couldn't wear the Union flag anymore because people would associate her with the kind of people that are sticking them up outside the hotels in Preston.
Well, I've thought about that in the past, where you think whether you wear like a piece of clothing with the flag on, whether someone would look at you and think, wow, he's one of them, do you know what I mean? And you think, oh, well, you know, it's a bit, you think, it makes you think a bit more about, you know, what you go out and wear and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it does, and that's a real shame, because it means that it becomes, as it was in the 70s, which you'll be too young to remember, and I am pretty much as well, but it became the preserve of the far right, and they want it back, I suppose, is the best way of describing it. I've really enjoyed listening to you, Charlie. Thank you for that.
I appreciate that.
The fact that, you know, two, three, four different things going on in your life, and all of them making you just reassess and rethink things. Can I say something to you without you being patronised?
No, go for it.
Promise. It's the thinking that will save us all. It's the thinking mm-hmm. about things that keeps us all honest, that keeps us all on an even keel. Seeing things and making you go. I got a few messages like this today. So I hadn't thought of it that way before. I hadn't thought of it like that before. And as long as you're doing that, then you and your future kids, God willing, you're all going to be okay. You're all going to be okay.
Well, can I just say one last thing, sorry?
Yes.
I'm just a working class fella.
No such thing as just a working class fella. I know what you mean.
Yes. I'm like a lot of most people in this country, and all I'm bothered about, all I'm worried about is I'm just scared for, you know, what's my family's future, that's all. I think there are a lot of people that are just generally worried about, you know, especially just worried, that's all. Just worried about the safety, and that's it. And then think it gets overshadowed by this political fight that's going on between the left and the right.
Yeah, well, it's not even the left and the right. There's plenty of people on the right who aren't racist, and plenty of people on the left who are. But I know what you mean, the way that the conversation at the moment seems to be between people who wouldn't think your girlfriend was British and people who think that it's blindingly obvious that she is and always will be. Ditto your future children. And Keir Starmer has actually waded into this field today in, I think, the most direct way so far. I'll share a little more detail of that with you shortly. We may carry on with elements of this, or we may turn our attention to really difficult conversation. Whatever you think of the royal family, you wouldn't wish serious illness on anyone. And the really difficult conversation you have to have with your children when the dread word cancer appears in your consultation.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, people across the country are gathering to mark the end of the First World War. The Princess of Wales is attending a ceremony for Armistice Day at the National Memoriam Arboretum. LBC's Scotland correspondent, Alan Sosinski, was at Glasgow Central Station for the two-minute silence.
Veterans were holding back tears here as the kilted bagpipers, which had played them in marching order, made way for the lone bugler, and then the hundreds around me fell silent. You could have heard a pin drop in Scotland's busiest train station as many stood with their heads bowed, others gripped wreaths of poppies in front of them. And then, as the silence came to an end, many offered a sombre salute to remember those who are no longer with us.
Prince William will join the King and Queen at Windsor Castle for a reception later. They'll be honouring veterans who served in the Pacific during the Second World War. The outgoing BBC Director General has told staff to fight for their journalism after Donald Trump threatened to sue the company. Tim Davey acknowledged a mistake had been made in how Panorama edited a speech from the US president. The UK's unemployment rate has risen to the highest level since 2020. The latest data from the Office for National Statistics shows it hit a 5% in the 3 months to September. Work and Pensions Secretary Pat McFadden insists work is being done to reverse it.
We have announced a youth guarantee which will offer every person aged 18 to 21 the chance of a training place, an apprenticeship, or ultimately a subsidised job. We're doubling the number of youth hubs which exist around the country, but I've also commissioned former Health Secretary Alan Milburn to do a specific report on young people and work.
A driver who crashed a stolen car into a care home in Sunderland has been jailed for more than 5 years. 21-year-old Sam Asghari Tabar led police on a 100-mile-per-hour chase in July. He pleaded guilty to robbery and causing serious injury by dangerous driving. And the government has set out a plan to phase out animal testing. They want to cut the use of dogs and non-human primates in medicine testing by 35% by 2030. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 88 points at 98.75. The pound buys $1.32 and €1.14. LBC weather, a wet and windy day for most of the UK with rain spreading towards the north and west. Mild with highs of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lottie Morley.
When BP asked me to read the voiceover for their new Wild Bean Cafe ad, I thought I knew what to expect. But when they told me I'd be reading the script next to a mountain waterfall, on horseback, strumming a harp, in a hailstorm, naked, ow, 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 well, that was wildly unexpected. Just like Wild Bean Cafe having a freshly ground signature espresso blend for everything from Americanos to flat whites in a fuel station. Wowzers. Wild Bean Cafe. Only at BP. Subject to availability at selected BP stores only.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It is 3 minutes after 12 and you're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I'm going to tease you for a tiny bit longer. Great calls in the last hour, as is often the case on this programme, but some calls are even better than others, and Charlie touching a heck of a lot of nerves, mate, if you're still listening. Thank you for that. I'm going to tease you for a little bit longer because I set it up wrong. So do you know who David Frost is? Not the late great broadcaster, but the Herbert who was responsible for negotiating Brexit and then started whining about what he'd negotiated before the ink was even dry on the deal that Boris Johnson signed. Not that it detained him unduly, because Boris Johnson, as with almost all the biggest idiots in the Brexit movement, put him in the House of Lords. Frankly, extraordinary, where presumably he sits next to the world's wrongest man, Daniel Hannan, who's also in the House of Lords. I thought I was joking the other day when we were talking about prisons, and I said, oh, I bet Chris Grayling's in the House of Lords. Chris Grayling is in the House of Lords. In fact, he probably in those circles. Kenny Badenoch put a chap called Toby Young. I would almost apologise to you if you don't know who I'm talking about, but you've now been introduced to his existence by me. It's frankly extraordinary. All of the people that used to whine about the abolition of the House of Lords and used to claim that it was, they'd probably done more by populating it with complete wallies than a million anti-privilege campaigners could have done in 100 years. How are you going to render the House of Lords utterly, utterly ridiculous? Well, let's put Daniel Hannan, David Frost, Toby Young, and you've probably got a favourite. In fact, send me, Chris Grayling, send me your favourite as well, and we'll put it on the list. I've completely forgotten why I was talking about the House of Lords. This is the problem with going off at tangents in the third hour of the programme. My mental acuity is not quite what it was in the first or the second hour of the programme. But David Frost is the guy that negotiated the... Yes, you're right. I should just write a script and read it all out. David Frost is the guy that negotiated the Brexit deal and then started complaining about it before the ink had even gone dry. And if I told you what his new job is, given my commitment to spreading the truth about the media political ecosystem that allowed Britain to be broken over the last few years, if I told you what job he's gone to do next, you'd think I was making it up. You'd think that we had a JOB generator whereby some of my favourite bugbears, the criminally and chronically underreported phenomena that explain how you could end up becoming the first population in history to vote to impose economic sanctions on itself, or put Boris Johnson in Downing Street, or put Liz Truss in Downing Street. If you wanted to understand how on earth you seed the ground, you create the context in which these obviously and objectively insane things can happen, then you need to hit quite a few marks. There's a few points you need to hit repeatedly. The utter unreliability of organs like the Daily Telegraph and the Daily Mail, for example. The ludicrous coterie of secretly funded lobbyists masquerading as think tanks in the environs of Tufton Street in Westminster. All of that going way back to when Rupert Murdoch bought The Sun. I've written a whole book about it. So if I had a generator, and you spin it like this, and it comes up with a name first. So press the button. Give me a name of one of these people. Ding, ding, ding. David Frost. Okay, now we press another button for a job that best sums up how pathetic this cronyism and this moral, intellectual corruption really is. Bing, bing, bing. What's the job? What's the job that he's got now? They've made him head of the IEA. And you think I'm making it up, like I made up the fact that Gary Lineker was the new Director General of the BBC yesterday. You think I'm making it up for chronic effect, even, or comic effect. It's sensational, isn't it? In fact, a few of you guessed correctly. Is he going to be running a Tufton Street think tank? Absolutely extraordinary. Extraordinary. I should probably be flogging a few more books on the back of the madness that's going on at the moment. The Rupert Murdoch chapter tells you almost everything you need to know about the Donald Trump situation. The Dominic Cummings chapter tells you almost everything you need to know about this decades-long attempt to undermine the BBC and why they're so desperate to do it. Did you know Dominic Cummings ran a secretly funded think tank back in the day that was largely dedicated to attacking the BBC? Did you know that? Said it yesterday and I'll say it again today. Nobody cares about the tiny amount of things they get wrong. All of the people that hate the BBC pretend that they care about the stuff that the BBC gets wrong. It's the stuff they get right that they really care about, up to and including Donald Trump. Mark my words. And I don't let me go home without playing you a little clip of Keir Starmer, finally. Well, actually, maybe that's not fair, but I'm unequivocally condemning the racism, the rise of the sort of racism that we were talking about in the last hour. 8 minutes after 12 is the time. This is really moving, and what I don't want to do, even though I'm going to ask you a question that invites two quite distinct opinions, what I don't want to do is turn it into an argument. I and I think we can do this together now. I think we've been doing this now for long enough to wade into really emotional territory where we can hold two very different views respectfully and kindly. Because I'm looking at the story, the comments by Prince William, one of the royals that you can still call a prince, about how they told their children about their mother's cancer. He has said, and this is where the royal family can be at their most helpful and their most powerful, actually, when they become a lens through which much more universal experiences can be viewed and discussed. In many ways, they're at their worst when they're swanning around in golden carriages, because that's entirely unrelatable. But you need the deference, you need the forelock tugging and the cap doffing to keep society stable, or to keep the plebs in check. But they're at their best, they're at their most powerful when experiences they have, which are common but not quite universal, receive attention and consideration that they wouldn't receive without, publicly they wouldn't receive without, somebody of that stature, somebody of that status making an intervention in the conversation. And what he's described is the difficulties of deciding whether or not to be completely upfront with their children about their mother's cancer diagnosis and cancer treatment, described in some interviews as a delicate balancing act. It's an interview he gave to a Brazilian television host during his trip to the COP conference in Rio this month, earlier this week. And he said something that all parents will recognise, whether they've got 47 nannies or not. He said there was no manual for being a parent, and everyone had to do what they felt was best in the circumstances. They felt, and he's at great pains to acknowledge that other people might have done it differently, and I will be at similarly great pains this hour as well. They felt it was better to be honest with their children rather than to hide stuff from them, because they felt that that would help them feel less anxious about what was to come. It's very individual, he said. It's moment dependent. That's a good phrase, how you deal with those problems. We choose to communicate a lot more with our children. Now, that has its good things and its bad things. Sometimes you feel you are oversharing with the children and probably shouldn't, but most of the time hiding stuff from them doesn't work. And I don't want you to feel, listening to this or reading these comments, that deciding not to tell your children that you've got cancer is the wrong thing to do. I very happily don't have any direct personal experience of this. I lost one of my closest friends, as you know, to a brain tumour, and his children were, I suppose, somewhat, they were very, very young. Old enough to know a bit of what was going on, or certainly old enough to know that Daddy was very, very, very poorly, and I think that the eldest was prepared for the knowledge that he was going to he was going to move on, he was going to pass away, but the detail would have been redundant of illness, not old enough to really get across the minutiae of treatment and stuff like that. So I don't think there's a right way or a wrong way. I just want you to tell me what... I want you to tell me about your way. That's all. There'll be someone listening to this who, very, very, very sadly, will be dealing with this problem soon, even though today they don't think that they're ever going to be dealing with this problem. I suppose it could be me, but my kids are much older now. So it doesn't really matter in the same way that it would if you were wrestling with the question of how much you should tell them. So I'm going to ask you how much you did tell them, and I'm going to ask you how you did it. How you did it. How did you tell your children about your or your partner's, about their parents' cancer? 0345 60 60 973. Or, and in a way, I think it's, I'm not going to say I really want these calls, but I would be a bit, I'd be a bit sad if we got to 1 o'clock and we hadn't had any calls from people who didn't tell their children anything or very much about what was going on. Because I think that is a entirely understandable and possibly correct course of action. As Prince William said, and fair play to the fella for choosing his words with incredible care, it's moment dependent, it's very individual. So I don't think there's going to be an objective algorithm for parental behaviour. It will depend partly on who your children are. You know your child better than I ever will. You might have two children, one of whom would probably be able to cope with this news quite well, and one of whom would fall to pieces. And only mum and dad really get that. Only mum and dad really know that. But the question I have for you is how do you do it? How do you do it, or why didn't you do it? The conversation with your own children, and I suppose that potentially terminal cancers throw up a whole heap of different challenges, but I think we're up to the job of talking about them. William's wife diagnosed, Kate, diagnosed following abdominal surgery in January of last year, you'll remember, and then chemotherapy, which obviously weakens you. The kids know something's going on. So what do you tell? Mummy's poorly? Or do you, how much of the truth do you tell them? And if it's none of the truth, then I don't want you to feel excluded from this conversation, and I'm pretty sure that Prince William doesn't either, to be fair. That's why he chose his words so carefully. So how do you do it? And why didn't you do it? Two questions. And I'm really interested in your answers. And remember, part of the reason for having conversations like this, and I have living proof that this is true in my inbox, and indeed in real-life encounters, is that people learn from our conversations. They will learn from your experiences, and they will be better equipped to deal with similar scenarios if, God forbid, they should find themselves dealing with similar crises and similar problems at some unspecified point in the future. Let me remind you of the number, 0345 60 60 973.
This is LBC.
A southern train is a place where family moments become more peaceful. Where you can spread out and a game of I Spy gets a scenic upgrade with snacks, stories and the occasional sheep for a bonus point. Less stress, more yes, with kids' tickets for £2 at southernrailway.com. Terms apply.
When you think of a hero, you don't necessarily picture a crumpet. But when Warburtons needed a hero to run marathons and raise money for Cancer Research UK, there was only one person to call. Crumpy, a 6'4" anthropomorphic crumpet, a.k.a. Lee from Sales in a crumpet suit. Did Crumpy help raise £3 million for Cancer Research UK? Oh, yes. Is Crumpy machine washable? We can only pray. Good stuff. It's baked in at Warburton's. Follow Crumpy's journey. Search Warburton's Good Stuff.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it, and there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 60 60 973.
12:17 is the time. There'll be cultural differences here as well. I'm fascinated by society's attitudes to serious illness and even to death, because they are so different. It's not part of the human condition to respond in a certain way. I think we're still, as with so many things that hold us back as a population, we're still slightly enthralled to Victorian values and Victorian hypocrisies. But the obvious truth behind the observation that knowledge is power, and that the more you know, the more power you have, seems to me to fall down when it comes to children sometimes, and trauma, and how much, for example, of a cancer diagnosis you would share with your children, how you would do it, or indeed why you wouldn't go there at all. Fatima is in Norbury. Fatima, what made you pick up the phone?
Hi, James. Nice to speak to you again.
Likewise.
I remember the first time I spoke to you a couple of months ago, we're talking about my 5'11", 14-year-old.
Yes.
Yes, and I was actually driving on the way to Marsden, and guess where I am today? I'm back at the Marsden.
Oh, wow.
Listening to your interesting conversations, and then obviously this is very close to my heart. Particularly with Kate and William, I got married shortly before they did. I was pregnant around the same time, or had my baby just before they did. And last year, January, guess what? I got cancer.
Oh,
just as Kate got diagnosed as well. So gosh. I was diagnosed with breast cancer. So, yeah, a lot of similarities there. I do agree in the sense that it is very individual to the child and individual to the circumstance, and individual to the cancer itself. So my children last year were aged 12. The eldest was 12 then. My daughter was 9 and my youngest was only 2. I spoke to the 12-year-old and 9-year-old separately. And
yeah. Well, you didn't sit them down together?
No. I didn't sit them down together because I know them and I know how to speak to them. And I think that the 9-year-old, my daughter, she probably needed a little bit more reassurance than the 12-year-old did. Because when I asked my 9-year-old, what does cancer mean? She said, it means you're going to die. That was the first thing.
Oh.
And I said to her, yeah. And I said to her, no, it doesn't, sweetheart. It doesn't mean that mummy's going to die. And I used a building blocks analogy. And I said, imagine that all these blue building blocks are the cells in our body. Then imagine that these red building blocks come in and they try to take over, and they're the bad building blocks. And what's going to happen to mummy? She's going to have treatment to get rid of these red building blocks to make her feel better. And what's going to happen is, while these building blocks are kind of getting bashed away, mummy's going to start feeling a bit poorly, and I might lose my hair, and I might look a bit different. I might not be as active. I may not be able to come to this club and that club and take you out on weekends or swimming, etc. Yeah. And that really did help her understand that, actually, you know what, mum's going to be okay, but she's going to be unwell. And it's that whole conversation, well, actually, isn't medicine supposed to make you feel better?
Of course.
Why is this medicine making you feel worse?
What did you say to that? What did you say to that?
Well, I said, Some medicine takes a bit of time. So with the building blocks again, when we're trying to break down, because these red building blocks are really bad and we need to kind of keep bashing them down. But then what happens is, while we're bashing them down, the blue blocks get bashed as well. So, and it's really explaining to them how they will understand, rather than actually, mum, it's cancer and mum's going to die. And with my 12-year-old, who was probably 5'8", 5'9", then, I don't know, he had a better understanding, but still he cried, and I had a cry with him, and I said, it's okay, and it's fine to cry, and it's fine to be worried, because I'm worried, I'm not going to lie, I'm worried, I don't know what's going to happen, and I don't know, because I wasn't sure I was going to have chemotherapy then as well, so... When you bring that whole thing into it, and, you know, the realization that actually I'm going to have chemo and
I can't pick a single hole in how you chose to handle this, and I wouldn't particularly want to be honest with you, in the context of, although Scott's been in touch to say, I haven't tuned into this show every day for 20 years to hear you not trying to turn something into an argument, but there's a first time for everything. Do you think, I mean, because your prognosis was hopeful, at least, wasn't it? Really?
Yes.
So if it hadn't been, I wonder if you would have handled things in quite the same. I mean, it would have been a completely different set of challenges. But it I don't know whether keeping stuff from children when you know that the end is going to be unhappy would be the kind of thing to do.
To that, James, I'd say I think it's purely based upon yourself as well as an individual then, because although prognosis, which I'm so grateful currently in Royal Marsden at the moment, so grateful for the care that I received, I have been left with quite a few side effects, and that's what I'm here to address today is one of the appointments from treatment. And these side effects, I've been told it should have gone away. So we're looking at sort of chronic side effects, but I'm still a half glass full type of person.
Of course you are.
I'm still advocating and really trying to get out the message for the voiceless, in better patient care, patient-led care, bridging the gap between healthcare and patients as well. So I think it does depend on yourself as an individual. However, I completely understand if you choose not to have that conversation, because it is so heavy.
Yes, it is. And the prognosis is going to be a huge part of that thinking process. And part of the reason I asked Fatima, and good luck today. It can't be much fun. However glass half full you are, it can't be much fun not knowing and waiting and crossing fingers. So we're all thinking of you as you head into that consultation. But I think I just had read Ryan's message shortly before you came on, and he said, please, 24 minutes after 12, there we go, just did it. Didn't I? Please don't say my name in the first line of the message, and I just said his name, so I won't read that one out. Apologies. Let's go to Farah, who's in Southfields. Farah, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Not calling about Gaza this time.
Carry on.
5 years ago, just as we went into the first lockdown, I got diagnosed with breast cancer. It was stage 2. I had 2 tumours in my left breast, and it was in my lymph nodes. My twin daughters were 10 years old, so there was no way they weren't going to find out, because from the very beginning, they said I was going to have the kitchen sink approach, which was, oh gosh, it was 15 rounds of chemo. 3 of those were going to be the really horrid stuff, 15 cycles of radio and 16 of antibody treatment. So it was pretty bad. It was fast growing. And because it was COVID, I couldn't just have the surgery and kind of model along. I had to have the chemo first. And the children were locked up in the house with me. So what we actually did is that I spoke to my oncologist, and she said, you have to tell the children. You have to tell them.
Right.
And what you
did they say why? Did they say why?
She said, because they are old enough to know, and you are going to look horrific, and you are going to be very sick.
Okay.
She's brilliant. She's Irish. She just spat it out. So I was like, okay.
You're going to look horrific. That's not sugaring the pill,
is it? She said, you may not lose all of your hair, but you're going to look very different.
Yeah.
And I interpreted as whatever. But what she actually said is, use these words, tell them that mummy is going to get better, and mummy's doctor is going to make her better, and they shouldn't worry.
Yeah.
And then she turned around to me very quietly, and she just said, my husband was in the room at the time, and she just said, and I and my team will do everything we can to help you keep that promise.
Wow.
So even now, it just makes me quiet.
Of course it does.
So we took the girls down to Wimbledon Park. It's, we were allowed to go out at that stage. Yeah. We were allowed an hour out. And we took I took them down to an area which I really dislike. I call it Dog Poo Alley.
Yes.
But it's the area of the park that we would never go anywhere near. And my husband and I sat them down, and we explained that I'd found a lump, that I was going to have some treatment. And they're identical twins, but they're extremely different in personality. One of them was really quiet, and she just went off and made me a daisy chain and sat down.
Oh, stop
it. The other one cried, because her godmother, they have different godmothers,
right.
Her godmother died at 42 of breast cancer and left her three
cousins. So that's what she immediately thought of.
Yeah, so they were like that, and then very quiet. We bought an ice cream, went home, because we wanted to protect our home space. That was, we don't want bad memories or traumatic stuff associated with home, because we didn't know how long we were all going to be locked in our houses for.
Okay.
So
that all makes sense as well, doesn't it? I mean, and that double response, the completely different responses, and the fact they're identical twins somehow makes that even more.
But they
remarkable.
They both that night got into my bed and howled. I mean, it was screaming. It was like, literally from like, sorry, like the bottom of their hearts.
Oh.
It was horrific. But you have to tell them.
And then in that moment, you just hold them close, right? You don't do anything else. There's no talking or explaining. That's when things go primal.
Yeah, because, I mean, and even to this day, I mean, I celebrated my 5 years remission in August. As I've told you a million times before, Dr. Victoria Rose was my reconstruction surgeon.
Yes.
Please donate to Ideals. So I did the 5 years, and I'm totally clear, and I'm extremely lucky with the care that I get. But even now, one of them is absolutely convinced it's going to come back.
Oh, she lives in fear.
She lives in fear.
And there's nothing you can do about that.
There's nothing you can do about that. I mean, the other one wants to be a doctor, so she's like, oh, you know, she looks at different things. And my surgeons, my doctors were brilliant because they sent a picture of my PET scan home with me one time. And the thing about fast cancer cells or fast-growing cells is they sparkle on the scan. They look like diamonds. So the girls couldn't say, Mummy has cancer. Mummy's got sprinkles. Sparkles, that's what they called it. Mum's got sparkles. And then eventually they could say the word. And then between then and now, 8 of my friends in their year group have been diagnosed with breast cancer. So they have supported their friends and other kids in their year group.
Good grief.
So there are good things that come out of this. But you have to tell them. You just have to tell them.
Not least in the context of treatments that are going to make mum look very, very, very different from what they are used to mum looking like. And it would just be weird, wouldn't it, to not go at least halfway there. But again, you know, the difference between dealing with a situation which you can imbue with hope and dealing with the situation, which also is what William could do as well. But there will be people listening to this. In fact, I've heard from some of them who... I didn't. And you can get it wrong. This is from someone who was 28 when he lost his dad. I was 28, James. My parents decided to tell us very little. I would have spent a lot more time with my dad in that final year if I'd known that there was no hope of him getting better. So I was staying away a bit, hoping and expecting that at some point he'd come out of it. That's another thing to think about that wouldn't be immediately obvious. 12:30 is the time. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Tim Humphrey has your headline.
The nation has fallen silent to mark 107 years since the end of the First World War. Services have been taking place around the country on Armistice Day. The Queen has laid a wreath at Paddington Station in central London. Asylum seekers can continue to be housed in the Bell Hotel in Essex after the local council failed to secure a High Court injunction. Epping Forest District Council took legal action against the owner of the hotel, claiming it was breaking planning rules. The outgoing BBC Director General has told staff to fight for their journalism after Donald Trump threatened to sue the corporation. Tim Davie acknowledged a mistake had been made in how Panorama edited a speech from the US president. LBC weather, a wet and windy day for most of the UK, with rain spreading towards the north and west, feeling mild with highs of 16 degrees.
LBC.
Whether you're managing a business or a football club, your team are your biggest strength. But when it comes to cybersecurity, they could also be your biggest weakness. 88% of cybersecurity breaches are caused by normal human error. So how do you help your team form the ultimate impenetrable line of defense? Just ask BT.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it. And there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
The £5 meal deal from McDonald's. Get a cheeseburger or mayo chicken, medium fries, 4 McNuggets and a medium soft drink for guess what? That's right, £5. It's not called the £5 meal deal for nothing. From 11 a.m. Not available on delivery. Carbonated soft drink upgrade fees apply. Participating restaurants subject to availability.
Train to Brighton with the besties. Immaculate vibes, as always. But I bet my ice skating is going to be pure chaos.
Oh, Em, you better hold my hand. Oh, I'm going up.
No, styled it out. I've got this.
Last one to the other side buys the hot chocolate.
Back on the train. Only fell twice.
Low-key legend.
We have to do this every year.
Download the Southern Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel and off-peak journeys. Southern Railway, where every stop is a story.
You asked, BT answered.
Keeping your team cyber aware is really important in the modern marketplace. Regular training on things like data handling, spotting threats, and securing their devices helps you keep them and your business safe.
Cybersecurity is everyone's business. Search BT Business Cybersecurity to find out more.
James O'Brien. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It is 12:33. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. This is a little bit different. You heard me, in fact, you've heard me on a few occasions talk about the passing of my friend Andy, who I mentioned a moment ago, and you could probably tell that I couldn't completely remember what approach they had taken with their sons, my godsons, when it came to preparing them for the worst, because unlike the calls we've taken so far, the prognosis in Andy's case was pretty much as grim as it can get from the moment that the tumour was discovered. Just by complete coincidence, their mum is listening and joins me on the line now. Andy's widow Lara. You did warn me that it might be me that struggles to get through this conversation rather than you, but here we are. So, what did you two decide to do, and how did you handle it?
Yeah. Hi, James. Hey. I'm calling just in case it helps someone else in this situation, really, because it's not a great place to find yourself. So he first had a massive seizure in the street, and that was the first we knew about anything, and was rushed to hospital and sort of vanished for a bit and had a series of tests, and we didn't really know what was going on. So that was the first. We had to just sort of explain that Daddy had a bit of a fall and the doctors were trying to work out what was going on. Then they discovered that there was a tumour, but we didn't know how serious a tumour, but his mother had died of a brain tumour, so we knew this could be really serious. So at that point, the children were 4 and 8, and we told them that unfortunately the doctors had found a lump in Daddy's brain that shouldn't be there, and they were going to work out what was the best thing to do about that, but the doctors were very clever, and Daddy was quite tired, and we should just sort of wait to see what happened. And I was in and out of hospital a lot, and we rallied a bunch of family around on a rotor, and we sort of made do. Unfortunately, after 10 days, he had the biopsy, and we did discover at that point that it was terminal. And that's when the first time, and it's very different for how we normally are, that we chose not to share the full information with them, because you can never unhear that, and it destroys your life from that moment forward. So we chose to say to them everything that we could about the treatment, whilst never promising that it would cure it. So we told them that because the lump was there, the doctors had decided that they needed to zap Daddy with a super cool laser gun, which was the radio, and give him some very strong pills. And we explained that they would make him very tired and he might not be able to play as much as he was. But, you know, the doctors knew that's what they needed to do to attack the lump. But we never said to make him better. We never said to cure him. And we left them in that situation for probably a year, because we knew, but we just thought it would destroy all their hope and destroy all their fun. So
there's nothing to be gained, really, from...
There was nothing to be gained. But you couldn't, like a couple of other people said, there reaches some situations where you can't hide it, sure. And they're not stupid, even at 4. They'll absolutely see the difference. So we felt that it was the right thing we do. We had to say something. He lost his hair, he lost his ways. It was all just very dramatic. And then as it got closer and we could see that things were really picking up pace. I don't know if we'd actually gone to palliative care, but we were getting close. I had to do the big conversation. I just made a bunch of notes about exactly how I was going to do it. I had those notes on my phone. I had a bit of a script. And actually, I shared that script with friends and family. So if any of them asked them any questions, they knew what we'd said. And I did that actually a lot of points along the way.
I remember that now.
And then I sat them down and had the horrendous conversation.
Did you do them together? Or did you do them separately? You did, and that helped, I think, because they can put their arms around each other. Yes.
Yeah, but just like, I think I caught one of your last callers saying two children reacted completely differently.
Yes.
So actually the littlest was 6 and the eldest was 10. And actually the littler asked a bunch of surprisingly in-depth questions for a 6-year-old. The 10-year-old said absolutely nothing.
Oh.
But I think it was good to do it together. And I think it is not a good thing to have to do. It's horrific. But it enabled them to slightly prepare for what was inevitably coming. And yeah, so we believed in openness to an age-appropriate level, and I think that did help.
And did they talk to him about it at all after the reveal, as it were?
Yes, in different ways. Yeah. So,
because that's got to help as well, hasn't it? To have had those some of those conversations with Dad. Whereas I'm getting messages, Laura, from people who never got told, including from someone who was 28 when it happened, and they still had hope right up until the last possible minute, which can't be the right way to do things.
I think it helped them, and it probably helped him because. If they wanted to say anything to him, they could. If they wanted to ask anything, they could. And, you know, we had all the, no, it's not fair, I don't want Daddy to die. But we also had a lot of, a lot of, it wasn't lots, weeks maybe of time for them to just get a bit ready. But, I mean, in truth, you're not ready when the day they came home and it had actually occurred when they were at school. But, yeah, I feel like information is key, and there's some amazing, if you are going to have to go in this horrible path, there's charities like Winston's Wish, and there's all sorts of, there are resources out there of ideas of what you might say, but then it's all about working out what your child's like and how they might best receive it.
And preparing yourself as well. I don't know that people would think of that, because there is advice there, there's help, albeit that two children can respond to identical news in completely different ways. There are ways of opening the conversation and knowing what questions to expect as well, because, as you say, you could be surprised by the, although anyone who knows your 6-year-old would not be remotely surprised at the intelligence and the insight of the questions that he asked. You might not see some of them coming.
No. And also just sort of, what would a child think death means at that age, or cancer means, or tumours mean, or how can you explain it in a conceptual way that they can get? There's lots of people have sadly had to go there before, so they did give me some ideas. And I think having to do it, I can still visualize it, I can still feel like I'm in the room, but it almost helps take you to the reality a little bit.
You can't, there's no kidding yourself if you're having to prepare the children for it, is there? There's no sort of avoidance that can come into play. Did the doctors, presumably the doctors would advise, well, it's not really the oncologist's field, is it, to get involved in this kind of thing? You're kind of left to reach your own decisions yourself.
Yes. I think once you get to the hospice stage, they have family groups and things that probably have resources. This was all in COVID, so we didn't have any of that. It was all at home.
Yeah,
some of your other callers. I think trying to find neutral spaces, like someone said, is super clever. Like, I like to deliver news, horrible news, in a place you're never going to be again. I agree with that person.
Yeah, I'd never thought of that before. I'd never thought of that before. It makes perfect sense when you say it out loud.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Before you go, just when I got your message a moment ago to say that you were thinking of ringing in, you said that you hadn't listened for weeks, Laura. I think we're going to have words next time I see you all. So get your answers prepared for that one as well. I think might be the. Hey, thank you for that. It will have been enormously helpful to
people. Well done. I think it's an important subject. I'm sure you're helping a lot of people.
Well, you are. I'm just the conduit, and of course we will continue to do everything we can to keep Andy's memory alive through the work that we do with the Andy Taylor Foundation, and of course the love that we share with his children whenever we can. Oh, 12:42 is the time. I've said it before, I'll say it again. You never know who's listening, do you?
Millions are out of work because of sickness, and now higher than expected unemployment figures give the government a quandary just 2 weeks before the budget. Can you find a job? And on Armistice Day, we remember.
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or our new LBC app.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Oh, recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it. And there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
When you buy a BMW approved used electric car, there are no surprises. You'll find the largest range and the widest choice. Naturally, every car has been meticulously checked by qualified BMW technicians. Hardly a plot twist. And they always come with a battery health report and at least 12 months unlimited mileage BMW warranty. Just as you'd expect. BMW approved used electric cars. Nothing new here. Search BMW approved used electric. Obviously.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different, should be fun. Or wobbly, or wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Oh, actually, this is very relaxed.
George is up the river cam without a paddle.
Train home, that was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby. Download the Thames Link Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel on off-peak journeys. Thames Link Railway, where every stop is a story.
Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prepped for the future you want. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Imad, a GCSE student in Year 11.
Alongside my core GCSEs, such as Maths, English and Science, I study creative subjects such as Media, Drama, Art and Design, Business and Music Technology, which are all recognised by the industry.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in Years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
Great to see you back at Specsavers. Okay, could you read out the letters on the wall for me?
Yep. D-E-A-L-S? Yeah, D-E-A-L-S. Deals.
Oh, right. Our Black Friday deals are eye-catching, but the letter chart's over here.
Oh, sorry.
At Specsavers, we've got all sorts of unmissable Black Friday deals, like up to £50 off one pair of designer glasses. Offer ends on 7th of December 2025. Conditions apply. Ask in store for details.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
It's 12:45. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where that was both unexpected and I hope you'd agree, very, very helpful, insightful ideas, really, and memories of how you tell your children the worst imaginable news that mummy or daddy is not going to get better. But also, because, of course, the conversation is prompted by Prince William revealing how he and his wife, Kate, spoke to their children about her cancer battle when the prognosis was more positive. But as it was Farrah, wasn't it, described the doctor telling her, you can't not tell your children because you're going to look, I shall phrase it a little bit more diplomatically, perhaps, you're going to look very, very different from what they're used to. So, and that other thing, I never thought of that, but both Farrah and Lara both saying, do it in a place where you're never going to go back to, which, of course, people during lockdown were denied. One of the hardest, I'm going to go again if I tell you this, I don't know if I can tell you, but one of the toughest things I've ever had to do, and in the context of what we're talking about today, this is negligible and tiny, but the way lockdown exacerbated things and magnified things, doing the eulogy at Andy's funeral, when a man who could have filled Westminster Abbey with friends and admirers, And we had to do the eulogy in a tiny little chapel. Loads of people watching online, but that there's little things you forget from lockdown that never get undone, do they? It is 12:46. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Jacqueline's in Battersea. Jacqueline, what made you pick up the phone?
Oh, James, I'm going to send you a hug down the phone.
Thank you, Jacqueline.
And I'm feeling very, very humbled by so many of your callers today.
Great people.
My daughter's actually in hospital at the moment having quite traumatic surgery.
Oh,
she discovered she had breast cancer earlier in the year, had a lumpectomy, and discovered that she has a genetic mutation. So it's all good. You know, it's a good prognosis. She's having preventative surgery. But from the off, her and her partner have been very, very honest with the children. And as a family, we've been very honest with her two boys who are 8 and 5. The reasons that she's done this is because she's got such a wonderful relationship with her boys.
Yes.
She's very close. She does look now very different to how she did a year ago.
How have they dealt with that?
They've been amazing. The eldest one is quite matter of fact. But the little one is probably, I don't say more empathetic, because they've both got empathy.
Yeah, more expressive, perhaps.
Yeah, much more expressive. And I mean, I had them last night, and he sent her a really lovely message over the phone this morning.
Yeah.
But you know, it's so difficult. Cancer doesn't affect just the person, and I don't want to negate or simplify this in any way.
For sure.
It is horrendous for the person who is going through it, but it's the ripple effect that it has on the rest of the family, the children, the parents, the family, the friends. We chose, for example, not to tell my mother because she's very aged.
Yeah.
And
interesting.
In the moment, she might, you know, get really upset and remember it, but you know, in
nothing to be gained from telling her, really, is
there? But there was something that resonated with one of your callers. She said about her one of her children is really, really frightened about it coming back.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how I am.
Oh, Jacqueline, of course you are.
Because she's my only child.
Yes. And she's in the best possible hands, as you know.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We can't control where our mind goes, can we, at times?
No,
let alone at times of difficulty.
No, exactly. But I just wanted to say how wonderful there is so much really fantastic literature out there to support families. I know that my daughter used a lot of the leaflets and books that were recommended at the cancer hospital that she's been attending, and family and her friends have just been incredible. And these are, you know, not only her lifelong friends, but her relatively new friends that she's met. Her mum friends, you know, from school. They've, you know, helped out with the kids, and it is just, you know, I hate that expression, it's a journey, but it has been such an affirmation of connectivity. And
you don't know what people are like, do you, until they're being tested, as it were, and you don't know how good people can be in difficult circumstances.
And there's so many good people in the world.
Completely agree. We need reminding of that sometimes, don't we? But you're absolutely right. And I think, I know you know this, but it never does any harm to hear it again. But the effort they put in now to keeping on top of things and checking and going back and making sure, it is amazing.
It is amazing.
It should give you some comfort. But logic doesn't always take the driving seat, does it?
I just wanted to ring in and add a sort of family perspective on this.
Absolutely, and you're part of that process as well. That's what you say about the ripple effects. But there is one thing I want to do, though, before you go.
Mm.
I'd like to give you that hug back, if I may.
Oh, you may indeed. And I tell you what, your godchildren are very lucky to have you as their godfather.
Let's not get carried away. Thank you, Jacqueline. Thank you very much indeed. 12:51, and good luck later. Be a nice little sort of gathering around the bed later today, with progress having been made and the road to recovery beneath all your feet. Emma is in Sunderland. Emma, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Hello. So I was actually an adult when my mum was diagnosed with terminal cancer. I was 37. And I knew that she'd been poorly. I didn't know what the problem was or how severe it was. And I had been worried about her. But when she was diagnosed, she chose not to tell me. And I think maybe she hoped that she'd get that opportunity at some point. And she swore my dad to secrecy on it.
Really?
She wanted to set me. Yeah, yeah. But sadly, her illness progressed so quickly that she never actually got the chance to tell me. I got
so it wasn't a conscious decision. She didn't not want you to know. She just never got the chance to tell you.
Part of me thinks that she didn't want me to know.
Right.
And I think maybe she would have come round in time.
Yes,
but
okay.
I think it's a combination of that mother's love, I think wanting to protect your child. You're always your mum's baby. Doesn't matter if you're 37 or you're 7. And,
tell me about
and
it.
And having her instinct to protect me, even as a grown woman, she put my needs before her. What could I have done? I think isn't probably what she thought. But the shock.
You'd want to know, wouldn't you? You prepare yourself for it as well. It's
James, I would have known everything about taking care of her. I would have known everything about appointments. I would have done the job that I was meant to do as the daughter when your mum's poorly. I would have done it, and I would have done it so well. But the shock of being told how poorly your mum is, and then pulling your car over and throwing up on the motorway and getting home and thankfully getting her last words, and then caring for her for a few days, I was like a rabbit in the headlights because I didn't know I was going to deal with this. It was like the rug was from underneath me, and the shock and then the anger. I was so angry. I was like, why didn't you tell me? I was angry with my dad. Why didn't you tell me? It took a lot of time to get over the shock and the anger. But now I'm kind of in a place where I respect her decision.
Good.
And I understand why she didn't tell me, but
you can still wish she had. So you can do can have two thoughts in your head at the same time, can't you?
Yeah. I could have been the daughter that she raised me to be and care for her as she'd cared for me, and I didn't get that opportunity in the way that I would have liked.
No.
So it was really hard. I was frightened to touch her when she was in bed. I didn't, because I'd never looked after a sick, dying person, and I was like, can I do this? Can I do...
Yeah.
And all that stuff I would have known. If I knew I was going to lose her, I would have been ready, you know?
I've never thought of any of that without talking to you today. And I'm so glad you've come through the difficulties to a place of peace, because you deserve it. But you remind me about how many people... And there's something worth stressing here, isn't there? Is that but people think... as they get older, that they're going to be a burden to their children, or they're going to cause their children heartbreak. And what you just said, I don't know if I can say it out. I'm in quite an emotional condition at the moment. But what you just said about wanting to be the daughter that she raised you to be, really drive that home, shouldn't we, with parents and grandparents, is that we want you to be but we want to carry what you describe as a burden. It's our privilege and our duty to do this. We want to help you with your pain, because...
That's how I saw it.
Of course,
my dad as well, you know, my dad was dealing with it all on his own, and the thought of me, poor dad, keeping this secret and managing the care, and, you know, my mum was obviously a lot more poorly than she let on, I think, to the doctors herself. And I think she was just terrified. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
I can't imagine sitting down with my child. I don't have children, but sitting down with a loved one and saying, I've got cancer, I'm not going to make it. Like, that conversation I have with, you know, I was the apple of her eye, James, and to have that conversation with the person you love most in the world, it must crush you.
Yeah.
And she didn't want to do that, and I can't blame her.
Bless you, though, for getting to that place, because the anger would have served no purpose whatsoever, would it? And you can understand what she did from a place of love, even as you wish she hadn't done it.
Absolutely. And I think it's such a hard call for any parent to make.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, you know, my mum was a wonderfully complex, independent woman. And actually, on reflection, I wouldn't have expected anything less from her than doing exactly what she wanted, even when she knew she was really poorly. She did what she wanted, and
That is also how she raised you, I suspect, isn't it? That's so that independence of thought and spirit. You can't, flipping out. Well, listen, you honour her memory. You definitely honour her memory. So thank you for that. And it's nice to end our conversation with a bit of a chuckle. It really is. Thank you. I'm going to read a couple of these out, because I think it's important. Lara touched on wanting to be of help to other people. Greg says, what a magnificent hour by you and your callers. My wife is currently having radiotherapy treatment. We have two kids, 10 and 5. This hour has resonated so strongly. And Lawrence, who had similar experiences, although as an adult, like Emma, when his parent passed. It's the first time I've ever listened to you live. Normally just do the clips online. I'm not sure why I randomly tuned in today, but wow, I really needed to hear this conversation. Thank you. I mean, that is almost it for today. You are and have been listening to James O'Brien on LBC. The time is approaching 12:58, and I obviously can't squeeze anybody else in this kind of subject matter into the into the time that's left available. So, as ever, apologies to Jason and to Greta, Paul, Terry and Nev, although I hope that almost everybody's position has been reflected this hour by somebody else telling a story about dealing with similar issues in similar ways. I said I'd play you the clip of Starmer finally getting his strapping his boots on when it comes to the rise in rancid racism in the public space, whether you're talking about social media or whether you're talking about politicians like Farage and Jenrick and Lamb and the rest of them. He was on ITV this morning, not actually talking to Lorraine, but on the Lorraine programme. And, well, better late than never, Prime Minister.
I think the political divide now is between what I call patriotic national renewal, which is what this Labour government is doing, bringing people together, whether it's partnership working here or across the country, finding those points of connection, or, and this is what I fear, the toxic division of Reform and others on the right in politics, where they're tearing our country apart. Some of the rhetoric we're hearing, racist rhetoric, divisive rhetoric, that frankly I thought we'd dealt with decades ago, is returning to politics, and it makes people feel very scared. We have to stand up to that racism, to that division, and we have to proudly say that to be British is to be concerned for others, is to be reasonable, is to be tolerant and compassionate, and we're proud of that.
Indeed, we are. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date on all the top stories and opinions, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts, including James O'Brien Daily, the best bits of this show every day, and Full Disclosure, long-form interview series, which has got, I look occasionally when we're doing a little thing for Christmas or recording a message for Spotify Wrapped, just have a little look at the list of people that we've done this year. It's nuts. Absolutely bonkers. This week's, by far from being the most famous person we've done, but the producer, John Lloyd, who's responsible for everything from Blackadder to QI and everything funny in between. Amazing man. Incredible conversation. Go and treat your ears by listening to that. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Tom Swarbrick, but now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you very much, James. Thank you. Prince William and you on LBC, not least just now with James, have spoken movingly about telling your children their parent has cancer or being the child that's being told. It comes as almost all NHS trusts fail to hit cancer targets. So if you didn't manage to get your call into James, we're going to return to this at 3. I'm going to talk about racism towards NHS staff. Interesting in light of what we just heard from the Prime Minister there. We know it's happening. But now Black and Asian staff have been left feeling deliberately intimidated, they say, as a result of flags put up in many parts of England. These are people going into people's homes to help to care for them on the NHS. But I'm going to start with those unexpectedly high unemployment figures. Can you find a job? Here's a job.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, a 2-minute silence has been observed across the country to mark Armistice Day. The Princess of Wales led the service at the National Memorial Arboretum in Staffordshire. LBC's Luke Shanahan was there.
Once the service finished, Her Royal Highness left her seat to see the newly dedicated names here on the Armed Forces Memorial. The Arboretum's often called a sacred space, and for good reason, because no matter where you stand, you're surrounded by memorials, hundreds of memorials to soldiers, civilians, people of different backgrounds, nationalities, beliefs, sexualities.
Asylum seekers can continue to be housed in the Bell Hotel in Essex after Epping Forest District Council failed to secure a High Court injunction that would block them living there. The council took legal action against the hotel owner, Somani Hotels, claiming that accommodating asylum seekers there breaches planning rules. The government says it wants to end the use of hotels in an orderly fashion. The mother of a young woman who took her own life on a hospital ward has criticised staff for indifference, ignorance, even at times cruelty, as an NHS trust was fined more than £500,000. Alice Figueiredo, who is 22, was in a mental health unit at Goodmayes Hospital in Redbridge. The ward manager, Benjamin Anin Akawawa, has been given a suspended sentence for failing to take reasonable care for the health and safety of patients. The BBC's outgoing director general insists he's very, very proud of journalists at the organisation. Tim Davies spoke as he arrived at the corporation's headquarters in central London, where he's addressing staff in an online meeting. But he didn't mention the threat of a $1 billion lawsuit by Donald Trump over the editing of a Panorama documentary.
They're doing work, I think, that's incredibly important. I want to thank every one of them. They're doing a wonderful job. Also, everyone across the BBC doing their thing for the UK. The BBC's going to be thriving, and I support every one of the team. I'm very proud of them.
Former Home Secretary Suella Braverman thinks the situation has left the Prime Minister in an impossible position. You can read her piece in full on the LBC app. Unemployment in the UK has reached the highest level outside the pandemic era for nearly a decade. Official figures show the jobless rate rose to 5% in the 3 months to September. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 76 points at 98.63. The pound buys $1.31 and €1.14. The LBC weather, a wet and windy afternoon for most of the UK, with rain spreading towards the north and west, feeling mild though, with a high of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Tim Humphrey.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. I want to talk about jobs. We've done a lot of talk about jobs and work and employment lately, haven't we? But today's figures showing the rate of UK unemployment has risen to 5% in the 3 months to September. It means, you know, it's easy to throw out statistics there and throw out the millions of people, the figure, the millions of people that we know are on long-term sickness benefits and out of work, people who can work when they're well, once they get well, and want to work as well, not being able to be in the workplace. And that's something we know is a problem. Well, so is this figure of 5% unemployment rate. The new official figures out today, the highest rate since the period covering December 2020 to February 2021, so the highest since COVID, really. It comes above the projected rate ahead of the budget. So that's not great news for the Chancellor or the economy or the people struggling to find work. My question to you is a simple one, and I'm sure often the reasons behind it can be, not always, but can be complex ones, which is, can you find work? Are you looking? And just how tough is it? Particularly if you've been made redundant, for example. We know that some businesses, for various reasons, are cutting down their staff. We know that some people have stopped employing because of the national insurance rise for employers. What effect has that had on your work, your job, your company? And if you're looking for a job, just how tough is it out there? Have you been able to find one? 0345 6060973, the number to call. You can text 84850, because, you know, the first thing to say about unemployment is the harm it does to the unemployed person in the long term, if it stays in play for too long. And then, of course, the damage it does to the economy at a time when we know we're struggling to pay for the things that we want and expect in our public services, for example. I'm joined by Simon Coombs, founder, director of Working Minds, a campaign that offers specialised wellbeing services to lots of different companies to help people across the UK to get back into work. Simon, thank you for joining me today. Good afternoon to you.
Sheila.
Are you surprised to see this rate going up the way it is?
Not really. I think you know, as many of your listeners already know, and you've covered just now, you know, we've seen increases in the national insurance contributions. We've got the workers' rights bill coming in to effect quite soon as well, which is going to impact also. And as you also know, we have extraordinarily high increments in people going off work or off sick with mental health difficulties. So no, it does not come as a surprise to me. And I think we're seeing the kind of back end of the cost of living crisis. You know, we speak about that. You've spoken about it many times on the show. That's not going away. And now we have a budget coming up, which I think leaves most of us pretty concerned.
When you say the back end of the cost of living crisis is impacting here, how so? How do you see that?
I think people have, you know, tried to tighten their belts as much as they possibly can, both employers, employees and unemployed people, particularly unemployed people. and there's only so far you can tighten that belt. And I think we've hit the very last bit that we can tighten, and where we go after that is probably not a good place.
Does all of that indicate that the government needs to look again at its economic strategy when it comes to employment? Because, of course, a strategy on employment isn't just about employment, is it? It's about all kinds of choices made about the economy and taxation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that's worth mentioning here in terms of strategies, now we here at Working Minds, we work alongside some prime contractors, for example, on employment employability schemes. So we work with the likes of Reed in partnership with friends of ours, Maximus and others. And as part of that arrangement, we sat down with Charlie Mayfield, Sir Charlie Mayfield's team, as they produced their Keep Britain Working report, which was published earlier, just a few days ago, and we're part of that report. And one of the things that came out of that report, one of the things we were very, very clear about, was that, you know, there is an answer to some of this stuff, especially for longer term unemployed people and possibly younger people that have sort of fallen into that bandwagon too, of poor mental health. And that is with properly personalised support, specialised support for employment, employability, alongside mental health support, it does work. Now, the difficulty that we have at the moment in terms of things like funding, there was a very successful employment programme across the UK called the Work and Health Programme.